the world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 11th of August 2023, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, anything please but Google. So just put in Not the BCFM Politics Show, and you find it. What will it do? You can listen to it live on there, or listen to the clips, which I'll be uploading later tonight. Anything you particularly you want to hear a bit more about, you don't think we had time for, the full clips will be up there. The full interviews. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military grade psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators, and the hatchet jobs on the heroes. Cancelling the vote winners like Boris and Trump, while Big Pharma's Matt Hancock and Bill Gates' crimes against humanity are all forgotten because the evil Putin, Goldman Sachs, Nazis, po-faced bunch of Bilderberg death trip losers, Nick Land's Dark Enlightenment drones want us slaves to their machines, as you'll be seeing more and more. In fact, I've finally just given up trying to get stuff from high streets. The only way you can get it is online, Nick, isn't it? Perfect in your little world of everyone doing what the machines want and cooping people up in their homes rather than them going out. Of course, the other wonderful thing about that is all that lovely retail property. You can just put a bulldozer in it and build a load more luxury flats or student flats in its place. Perfect for the land speculators. That's handy, isn't it? So anyway, we've now got a wife-murdering king in his accelerationist cults, now waging open war on the British people. That is, well, they're not quite open war, is it? Well, we certainly would talk about it like that. The idea really is to have a cost of living crisis which stops people being able to afford anything, particularly their rents or mortgages. Totally impossible for many of us now. The idea is to navigate us through this Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution. It's Irish Republican Labour member Martin Summers. I suppose, is it fair to call you an activist, Martin? How active are you in the Labour Party?
Well, I haven't been active in recent times because I've been working, so I haven't had time. But I've not resigned my membership, I'm not intending to do so.
Good. Well, what do you make of the latest developments within the? I mean, we had quite a good chat last week, didn't we, about Keir Starmer and his membership of the Trilateral Commission? It seems that there is a real problem with free. I mean, this is Crispin Flintoff's analysis that it's actually a terminal problem with free speech that they've got in the Labour Party these days.
Well, I mean, we've got a witch hunt going on against the left of the party, and there's no sign of that letting up at all, and therefore that causes a problem for us, and obviously may also cause a problem for Starmer. He's got a by-election coming up against the SNP up in Glasgow. All of this right-wing direction he's pulling the Labour Party in, we'll see how that goes down in Clydebank, because in actual fact people up there have got an option. They can re-elect the SNP.
Yeah, well, that's most likely to happen.
They've only got one member.
Yeah, but what do you think is going to happen up there?
Well, I think the SNP are going to hold it because it was their seat in the first place, and they took it from Labour years ago, and they're going to say, well, look, Keir Starmer is a right-wing English person.
Well, do you mean despite the meltdown in the SNP leadership?
There's been a problem in the SNP. They've had some difficulties in recent times, but that doesn't mean that their core vote is going to go to Starmer. It just ain't. If Starmer wanted to appeal to those people, he needed, for example, to say he was going to repeal the two-child cap on benefits. But he went out of his way to say he wasn't going to do that. And the SNP have quite rightly pounced on that and saying, this English guy doesn't understand the problems of inner-city Glasgow. vote for us.
So what do you make of this decision of the Labour Party as someone that's been in the Labour Party, well, the new membership, the new leadership, as someone that's been in the party since the 1970s? It does seem a little bit weird to be penalising poor people for having a child.
Well, it's just morally wrong. And he said he wasn't going to change it because he's trying to get activists like myself to leave the party. He's trying to alienate us. And he's also trying to reach out to those tabloid Tory voters in the red walls in seats in England. But in Scotland, this is going to go down like a lead balloon. They've got one sitting MP in Scotland. They're hoping to take more because of the problems the SNP are having. But Starmer's approach will not run in Scotland. It just won't. And he's not going to get anywhere with it. And that means that he may not get an overall majority under first past the post, which means we could then have a hung parliament and then things start to get interesting because Starmer won't be able to get his way in a hung parliament.
No, he's not very. That's very unlikely, isn't it? I mean, it might be a little bit like Jeremy Corbyn in 2017, mightn't it?
Well, except that the Tories managed to,
Well, that's what I'm saying, is the Tories will swing a deal and the Tories may well swing a deal and shut him out.
Well, no, because nobody will do a deal with the Tories. This is the problem they've always had. Nobody will touch them with a barge pole, apart from the Democratic Unionist Party. Nobody else will do deals with them. The Liberal Democrats have once bitten twice shy on that front, aren't they?
Well, we'll see, I suppose.
No, they won't. They won't. So I think the best result in the next election would be a hung parliament with Labour as the biggest party. But, it's a fruit machine. Who knows whether that's going to come up? This is actually really problematic because we've got the biggest crisis facing this country in probably 100 years. And the dysfunction of the political system because of first past the post leads to basically the wrong people being in charge. You've got less votes than the people who got more votes. And that's a big problem when you're going to war with Russia, where Putin is going to stand next May in the election in Russia, and he's going to win with a stonking majority. They can't do that in the West. They just can't do it because the system doesn't allow it.
I mean, isn't it actually largely to do with the party system, which puts all the people in power in both of the major parties now, Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak, that ordinary people, certainly Conservative voters, even Conservative members don't want Rishi Sunak. These are the characters that the voters don't want. And the idea is you're given a choice of voting, doesn't matter what system you've got, between a whole bunch of people that nobody actually wants to run the country.
Well, no, the problem is we've got, as in the United States, a one-party, two-party system, where in actual fact, if you want to get the other lot out, you have to vote for your team, because if you don't, they will come back. And that means, of course, that the oligarchy control the game, which is why you have to change the game and change the political system. And of course, in Ireland, Scotland and Wales, the system has been changed as a result of a war in Ireland. They had first past the post in Ireland until the bombs went off and people started being murdered. And then they had to change it. Is that what it's going to take on the streets of England? We're going to find out, aren't we?
Well, I mean, they don't have it in Holland, and we're going to be hearing later.
They do have it in Holland. They
They have proportional representation in Holland. They don't have first past the post in Holland, and yet they have a very dysfunctional parliamentary system, as we'll be hearing a bit later, I was going to say. After the break, we're going to be hearing from Millie, Jungle Bus Millie, who is Dutch, and she was a journalist in the 1970s. She'll be telling us a little bit about the scandal which brought down Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was the ex-SS officer who was the chairman of the Bilderberg conferences for the first 20 years. But, you know, it's good you picking on this whole business of the sort of, you know, party system being such a mess, Martin. A lot of people are thinking, you know, Labour or Tory, well, it's like the A team and the B team, really, of the same organisation. That organisation, of course, being the City of London and the corrupt money launderers there. I was invited up to London last Sunday to speak at a No to NATO rally, which I was very pleased to be able to do. It's very kind of them to ask me. But one of the other speakers, who was quite a bit short, he's about a third of the length of mine. I did about 15 minutes. He did quite a short speech, really. Is a guy called Neil McRae. That's N-I-A-L-L McCrae, M-C-C-R-A-E, who I'd not come across before, but he had some fascinating things to say about this whole idea of left versus right being just about a kind of divide and rule.
Rule of the establishment to divide and rule. In reality, Labour and Conservative are a uniparty. Yeah. They're working in unison for a global agenda. Opposing war is not an exclusive preserve of socialists, it's also a concern for libertarians, social conservatives, and any decent people.
Yes.
The warmongers are not on the extreme left or the far right, but in the so-called centre. This is the third way of Tony Blair. It's the politically correct orthodoxy, the progressive virtue-signalling intelligentsia who cast themselves as rational, responsible, caring and green. They're none of those things. This is the place of snobbery, ignorance and hypocrisy. The real middle ground is the ordinary folk who want peace and liberty in a cohesive society. Back in 2016, in the EU referendum campaign, I first realised that the left-right paradigm had lost its meaning. Pro-Brexit rallies had communists standing alongside UKIP supporters. And as conceptualised by David Goodhart, women are somewheres rooted in our communities versus the cosmopolitan anywheres. In the EU campaign, the BBC and cultural and educational institutions were blatantly biased. But it's much worse now with Ukraine. It's not merely imbalanced. Nobody is allowed to utter a contrary opinion or to state inconvenient truths. The moral narrative, or rather the immoral narrative, is never challenged. Yet people are waking up, particularly in the USA, where the spectre of the Vietnam War has risen. A CNN poll this week showed a majority of Americans oppose any further military supplies to Ukraine. But whereas in Westminster, where not one of the 650 MPs has spoken out against war or pushed for peace, in America, two leading presidential candidates are on our side. Donald Trump wants to leave NATO. But do you think the deep state will allow that?
No.
They'll jail him if they can get away with it. And then the main challenger will be RFK Jr. He's against the globalists too.
No kidding.
But they don't jail Kennedys. They shoot them dead.
Yeah.
The real divide is not left versus right,
but
ordinary people versus the totalitarian elite and the professional managerial class that supports them, sending more and more money to the military-industrial complex. It's stealing from the poor to give to the rich. We don't need a Labour or Tory revival. We need a new Robin Hood.
Oh, I love it.
Thank you.
So that's Neil McCrae there, speaking outside Downing Street, opposite Downing Street in Whitehall last Sunday. Martin, he's really there saying the centrists are the warmongers. Is he right?
Well, they clearly are the warmongers. But the centrists, to my mind, are actually quite right-wing. So, you know, I think the idea that the left and the right has disappeared is, it's jejune, it's not true.
I mean, isn't Starmer a Labour centrist?
Yes, he is, and he'd be proud to say so. He is basically representing the establishment inside the Labour movement, and they've got various mechanisms of control. And we're because of the way the system is set up, there's only certain things we can do. It's like, you know, the rules of the game are that, you can knock the bails off if somebody walks out of their crease in cricket and so on. And these rules mean that we're herded into this centrist situation, which is actually very right-wing. You know, the consensus centre is in fact extremely right-wing in terms of economics, for example. There's no challenge to the basic structure of capitalism, even though the banks are completely insolvent, and it's been obvious for years. There is alternatives. You say it isn't just Labour and Conservative, certainly not in Scotland or Ireland, for example. It just isn't. It's just not. They haven't got a foothold, really. In those
countries.
Well,
he's also pointing out there that in the United States, there's now a majority that actually of voters that actually oppose sending any more arms or support for Ukraine at all. Sounds to me like the cause of Zelensky amongst the American public has totally lost.
Well, it is. And at some point, there's nothing more to send in any case. Even if they wanted to send stuff, they haven't got anything to send.
Well, yes, there is, because some of the arms manufacturers have started to up production in the West, and so their ammunition is going over there.
There's nothing like enough, Tony. The Russians have been preparing for this war since 2014, and they've got a nationalised industry producing all their weapons for them at cost. What we've got is a big scam that allows people in the cabinet now and people in the Tory in a future Labour cabinet to be on the board. Ex-generals are on the board of British Aerospace, for example, who are making massive profits out of what's going on. So it's all going to plan in that sense. But of course, in terms of winning wars, the Russian nationalised arms industry is thrashing them, and they're never going to be able to beat them, because even if they started doing the right things right now, it would take another 10 or 15 years for them to be anywhere near where the Russians have got to. So the capitalism in the West is in a state of collapse. It will collapse, and then left and right won't disappear, Tony.
I'm not so sure capitalism is collapsing. I think it's doing rather well obviously, to a certain extent, many of the small and medium businesses and the cost of living crisis is causing all sorts of trouble. But the super rich, Martin, I mean, which we could just call a capitalist class if you wanted, are doing extremely well out of this. And they're not going to be walking away from this current situation. All the time, wealth is being funneled more and more into their hands, and they're hardly being taxed at all.
Well, that's right. So it's been a great success for them. But in terms of having an efficient system to fight the Russians and the Chinese communists, it's no use at all. They are going to win. The African countries are turning away from the West. They're going to repudiate their debts. The banking system will go down. Now, what will happen is the wealthy will have all of their money and they'll have their gated communities. But there'll be plenty of people outside those gated communities who will have nothing to lose.
It sounds like,
in a country like America, you can hide. In a country the size of Britain, you can't.
Well, it sounds to me like Britain will become like, I don't know, Bolivia or, you know, one of these third world countries.
We're going to become more like the United States, including gun crime and prison numbers and all the rest of it. And the United States is going to become more like Latin America, where people die every day because there's no justice.
I mean, why is it that we've got, I mean, as Neil McRae points out there, why no MPs speaking out about this Ukraine war then? So all of them, it seems they're afraid to oppose it.
Well, you have got some who have raised some criticisms, the usual suspects, Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonald and others. But they, of course, as we all know, are losers, so we don't have to listen to them. And in any case, they've been fairly pusillanimous about it because they don't understand what's happened in the Ukraine. The Russians have come in to support their people who voted to leave the Ukraine, just as the Irish voted to leave the United Kingdom in 1918. And they've got this idea in their heads that there's some justice in the Ukrainian cause, and there isn't. There's none. None at all.
Well, I was very refreshed going up to Whitehall to meet a chap called Keith Whitty. He's one of those people who are actually living full-time opposite Downing Street. I think Gazar, who was one of the anti-lockdown campaigners, was there for a while, and maybe last year for a little while. But anyway, there's now a sort of permanent presence. So if anybody's up in London and you're in Whitehall, go and drop in, you know, maybe a little bit of bottled water for them, a bit of food, maybe a bit of a donation. Go and say hello to those. And they're in somewhere called The Pen. It's some iron railings right opposite Downing Street. And then, in fact, going past Downing Street, there's four rows of metal. There's like sort of metal Harris fencing on the outside. Then there's some more metal gates. And then there's these massive iron railings. And then behind that, there's another load of these pop-up bollards that come out of the road. I can remember as a kid, Martin, I don't know if you can, just walk, you know, you used to be able to just walk it down into Downing Street. That was when the country was at ease with itself, back in the 1960s and 70s.
Well, from the 1970s onwards, there was an internal civil war in the country, so things, security had to tighten up quite a bit, didn't it? You know, it's all very well saying we used to have a democracy.
You're talking about Northern Ireland, yeah.
Yes, and of course there were two. There was an attack on Downing Street by the IRA, which nearly killed John Major and all the others sitting around the table of the War Cabinet, as it was called at the time, for the invasion of Iraq in 1991. There isn't that threat anymore, but there's plenty of other threats, and it's not so straightforward to imagine that we've never really lived in a democratic society, so it's not really.
Well, what I'm saying, I suppose, now is that it's very obvious that it's not a democratic society, and it's certainly not a society at ease with itself, where Rishi Sunak hangs out in Downing Street, you know, with all these armed police and these various barriers, metal gates and things blocking the way. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Keith Whitty, who lives permanently opposite Downing Street in The Pen.
My name is Keith Whitty, Monkey Magic News on YouTube, BitChute and Telegram. I came here originally to support Simon Parry, who is Box Clever Army. We started off here with a chair and an umbrella and some waterproofs. And over time, we built it up to this over 17 weeks. Simon was kicked out of Westminster. He's now barred from Westminster for publicly asking a politician, a public servant, in public, as a member of the public, some questions. He then got labelled as harassment and even stalking in the mainstream media. So I'm here because...
Well, let's just say a bit about this, because it's a little encampment in Whitehall, right opposite these gates of Downing Street. Now, I can remember walking past here as a kid, in fact, driving past when the night Margaret Thatcher was booted out, mm-hmm. tooting our horn and playing the beat Stand Down Margaret at the top of the volumes. But and what we've seen with happening with Downing Street now is you've got, I think over there, if you look over there, you get four different layers of security. You've got automatic bollards that come out of the road, you've got two completely separate gates, plus you've got the Harris fencing stuff in front of everything, and you've got a whole load of armed police. I can tell you, you know, it was back in the 1980s,
correct,
there was nothing. You could walk down Downing Street, walk back again, and it's a high security zone now.
Yeah.
But you're actually living right opposite, and this is what's happened here, is you've set up some tents and things like that, and you've actually got this metal railings all around this area.
So the metal railings were put up by, they call it The Pen, and obviously you put animals into a pen. Yeah, so we've changed it from a pen to the crib. So now it's more like MTV Cribs. We have comfort, we cook, we clean, we have, what would you say, our coffees in the morning.
It reminds me a little bit of Brian Hoare and his protest in Parliament Square.
Oh, really, yeah? So I don't know much about that.
But he had a whole camp on Parliament Square. This is a decade, 15 years ago or so.
I can't remember. We kind of started, as I said, just with an umbrella and a chair, and we've kind of developed it into this now, as I call it, the crib.
So what's it about?
So I'm here because basically the world is upside down. I'm mostly here for the sexualization of children, the adrenochrome, the trafficking. We are against WEF, the World Economic Forum, against CBDC, the Central Bank Digital Currency, against people being tortured in other countries, for protesting, from Iran to Pakistan to Burma, all these different places. So every single day there are protesters that pass, and let's say the public, because this is between Big Ben and Trafalgar Square, so we get everyone from all over the world talking to us, and it's a good response. People are starting to turn around. They just don't know where to go or what to do, so they need targets and goals. So
well, it's all very easy to be campaigning against things. The point of the thing, we don't like that, we don't like that. But you've also got to be surely looking for holding up our light, our candle. Ah. What kind of world do you want to see? So is there anything you get behind?
Oh, yes, 100%. So everything from our freedom of speech. So I started off, there was an old man called Eric Levy, who's passed away now. But he got me into protesting when I saw him on a YouTube channel. So I went out for Julian Assange, and I saw that when people chant, so they go, we want this, we want that, nothing really changes, and the people walking past, they put their heads down, they squinch their eyes, and they're a bit kind of taken away by this kind of shouting. So over time, I've realized, I used to be in sales and marketing, that music, good vibrations, smiles, not talking to people, but allowing them to talk to you. I've got this idea where we should all go to our local parks and open spaces for 3 days and shut the world down ourselves. Empower humanity by doing nothing to change everything. So have local business sell us food, drink, barbecue, ice cream for the children, bouncy castles, and a large stage where we all entertain each other. We could go home for a wee or for something to eat or sleep, but once it's there, it's for empowering humanity. When you get there, there should be a big stone that says, I tried to change the world, I stay, and the date. And engrave our names onto that stone and let no man or woman come and take it. After the 3 days, we can then walk to the halls of government and revoke our consent to their rule. Because they are our servants. They think that they're our masters, but we're the cogs that make the world turn, and we have the power united. So I say, by doing nothing, we can change everything. Don't go to work, don't turn your electricity, don't turn on your TVs, and go out and reconnect with your neighbours. It's going to be outside your doors. All you need is 3 people in each local area. I'm going to try and film how to do it, how to market it, how to get it out there. And it's not as difficult as everybody says. And all I hear from some people are, oh, it'll never happen. Well, they can happen Christmas, and they can happen the Queen's Jubilee or anointment or a long weekend. So surely they can change the world by doing nothing for 3 days and not going to work. So that's really why I'm here.
What about the cost of living crisis? This is hitting the country really badly now. What with fuel prices, energy bills, everything's going up, particularly food prices, enormous inflation, 100% in some cases, even more, with over just over 18 months in food prices. There seems to be a bit of a squeeze going on, and now that they're saying is they're putting interest rates up, so even people paying rent and mortgages, they're having to be paying more, and it doesn't seem to be doing anything to stop inflation, which is what they're trying to stop supposedly. Anyway, what about this fact that so many more people are now worried about losing their home?
Right, it's an agenda that's been around for a very long time. We're now talking about the universal basic income coming in, the Great Reset, the CBDC. They want to give you cash and you'll be happy and delighted. As the price of food and fuel and your rent, everything going up, and then you become controlled because you're then now dependent on this universal basic income. They're already giving it to teachers in Wales. Now, also remember, teachers, they're the ones that teach your children, the ones that are sexualizing them now and teaching them in books about masturbation at the age of 4, telling them to go home and discover themselves or ask their fathers about their erections and ejaculations. These people are the ones that have legal guardianship of your children inside the schools. So remember that, because if there's another pandemic or whatever else, those teachers can take your children out of the school and bring them away somewhere, even have them jabbed, and then tell you can't have them back until you're jabbed. So when you say the price of everything going up, this is a world, right, where it's played by chess masters, and we're playing tic-tac-toe. After one current affair, after the next. These are agendas that they have in place for a very long period of time.
So how do we fight back? That's the bottom line, isn't it?
As Piers Corbyn would say, resist, defy, and do not comply. As I just said, 3 days of doing absolutely nothing. That's how we change things, by doing nothing, because we're the cogs that make the world turn. We have the power. It's for people to decide. They need targets, they need goals. I don't have all the answers, but we can have a foundation and we can decide after that.
So how do people follow your work online and find you here?
So I'm outside 10 Downing Street in the crib 24 hours a day most of the time. So I'm here all the time. But as I said, Monkey Magic News, YouTube, BitChute and Telegram. I haven't been uploading lately because I've been here, I've been busy. But what I'm going to do is launch something. Everything I've just told you now and how to do it. And I'm taking a journey from London over to Ireland and going up a mountain called Croagh Patrick and doing lives so that people understand and have a listen to me. And kind of let's see if we can get people on board, you know.
Okay, Keith Whitty, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So, yes, not quite live, but that was just from Whitehall. Martin, he's pretty clear that, there's two main thrusts to his kind of reason for being out on the street and doing this sort of thing. One is the sexualisation of children, and the other one is this move towards the central bank digital currencies. Now, I'm hoping we'll have Nick Corbishley, the author of Scanned, on next week's show, giving us an update, really, how all these central bank digital currencies are going. But it does seem that the increase in inflation, there seems to be some sort of deliberate cranking up of the economic nightmare, you know, this Mr. Micawber thing, where you've just got less coming in than your outgoings and everything turns to a nightmare, in order to bring in these kind of new systems of money, new systems of finance.
Well, inflation is in fact coming down as a result of the rising interest rates. It's going to cause a recession, which will turn into a depression in China.
I thought it was coming down because the fuel prices have been coming down, petrol and diesel.
No, but because they've been raising interest rates, it's gradually squeezing demand out of the economy, and that brings inflation down. But of course, it's going to crash the economy. In China, I was reading this week, they've got deflation, which means although the economy is growing, prices are falling, which means that companies go bust. Now, we're possibly going to get a massive crash out of all of this. Now, it may be that they've got a plan for what they're going to do when the crash happens and all the rest of it. And they will try and, you know, I mean, you know, they've been trying to steer everything in the directions they want it to go. World Economic Forum and all the other things that the man's going on about there. There are no easy solutions. What he's calling, therefore, is a global 3-day general strike. And that's quite difficult to organise. It really is. And we had a 9-day general strike in 1926, but it didn't change anything. General strikes take place quite frequently in France, and they used to be taking place quite frequently in Greece. They are definitely necessary, but they don't necessarily lead to change. Because the odds are stacked against them.
Yeah, well, I'll put it to
ultimately,
you.
This is going to be decided on the battlefield. And well, it's being decided on the battlefield.
I mean, are you talking about the battlefield of Whitehall, civil unrest?
Well, all the battlefields across the planet. There's all people dying every day struggling for their rights. In Peru, there's still an uprising going on against the coup in Peru. And loads of people have been killed. Lots of indigenous people have been killed.
Oh, yeah.
And that's going on all the time. That's been going on all the time while people in the West have been...
Well, let's just look at the strikes for a minute. I mean, he is suggesting that strikes are a possible way of doing something here. But I put it to you that actually the Department for Transport and Rishi Sunak and the government generally, and of course their backers in the city and globally, are rubbing their hands when they're seeing these strikes. They're thinking, well, this is just more money that people are not going to be spending on the railways. Excuse me, and they are going to be spending, putting it in their petrol tank as they drive backwards and forwards to holiday across Britain and cause all sorts of jams as they are doing every sort of weekend here on the M5 as it crosses just past Bristol down into the West Country. And so actually what's happening is it's all rather benefiting the oil company shareholders and people like that. The strikes are getting very, very little in terms of settlements from the various staff. I mean, we've got, for example, the junior doctors on strike again, and there's been some settlement with the nurses, etc. But they are absolutely, it seems to me, willing to put up with these strikes, knowing that there isn't a general election for a while, and so they're just happy for these public services to crumble. After all, they are Tories.
Well, that's true, Tony. But you pointing out all the difficulties that people have to go on strike, to vote for it, to stick with it when they're on strike. They have to settle for less than they wanted and all the rest of it. Your man there just thinks we can all just walk out of work for 3 days. How does he live? Is he on benefits or has he got private income?
Well, no, neither. Oh, look, Martin, I think you're being a little bit narrow-minded there. He's getting donations from members of the public, just giving him food as they come past. Some of them possibly civil servants on their way to work.
Okay, he's entitled to his views, and I'm willing to listen to anybody's views. But there isn't what it is a jumble of ideas, and there's no strategy there, none whatsoever. And it's all very well people saying, "Well, we all just go."
So, what's your strategy?
You have to work in the trade unions. You have to work to change the electoral system. And sometimes you have to take up weapons, Tony. They did it in Ireland in the 1970s. Do you remember?
Well, you seem to be suggesting, really, the only way to do it is to pick up the gun.
I'm not saying it's the only way to do it, but the only thing that's stopping them is what the Russian army are doing in the Ukraine. That is what it's about, Tony. It isn't just about let's all realise what the World Economic Forum is trying to turn us all into slaves and we're going to free our minds and then we'll all be free, because it doesn't work like that.
No, you may well be right. Anyway, the keynote speech, I suppose you would call it, came from at the No to NATO rally on Sunday. There was a crowd of around about 200, 250 people. They're a smart lot. Who helped me out with my speech when I forgot the name of the Day of the Jackal film. I was reminded by the speaker, by the audience. So what was that film where the CIA try and assassinate de Gaulle? Well, apparently that is or isn't the actual supposed, but it certainly was at the time when the Americans were getting really, really annoyed with de Gaulle. So was Chris Williamson, the former Labour MP, one of Jeremy Corbyn's right-hand men, who, if you remember, there was an article, I think it was The Shakespearean Tragedy of Jeremy Corbyn by Neil, if you remember the name of the writer, Martin? No,
I don't.
No, anyway, Chris Williamson was one of those MPs who was a very, very great friend to Jeremy Corbyn, who he treated worse than he treated enemies like Margaret Hodge. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Chris Williamson, former Labour MP, at his talk at the No to NATO rally.
We've got a former Labour MP and a new Workers' Party of Britain member, Mr. Chris Williamson. Make him welcome. Thank you.
Welcome, everybody. I mean, I just want to start really by saying that we're ruled by psychopaths, aren't we? Yes. It's very appropriate, I think, that we are here opposite Downing Street this morning, and on this day, on this 78th anniversary of the dropping of the first atomic weapon on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. Can you hear me better now? Yeah, sorry about that. But you know that mindset, as Richard has pointed out, I mean, there was no need to drop the atomic bomb on the city of Hiroshima. It was, as Richard has said, a message to send a very clear message to the Soviet Union. It was an expression of the United States' offensive power. And that same mindset exists in the minds of the political class to this very day. And we have to ask ourselves, why does NATO exist? I mean, Richard touched on this point as well. We were told, weren't we, that when the Soviet Union collapsed, we were going to benefit from a peace dividend. The Warsaw Pact dissolved. But far from the peace dividend being a benefit to the people of Britain and across Europe and indeed the United States of America, we saw NATO actually expanding. It's now nearly twice the size that it was when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. So what's the purpose of NATO? Essentially, it is a muscle man for Wall Street. It's a vehicle for the military-industrial complex, because war is incredibly profitable, isn't it? You can only use a missile once. And billions and billions, over $100 billion have been sent by the United States of America. Billions of pounds have been sent by the British government. And we've got 14 million people living in poverty in the United Kingdom. People can't afford to pay their fuel bills and their food bills. And yet we are prepared to send money to prolong a proxy war in Ukraine. It's an absolute outrage and a disgrace. But you know, was provoked by NATO. NATO adopted the Bucharest Declaration in 2008, saying that Ukraine would become a full member of NATO. This is a very clear red line for Russia. Just imagine if a country on the border of the United States of America teamed up with China and Russia in some sort of military pact. They wouldn't wear it, would they? Some of us in the audience, I'm sure, remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Monroe Doctrine, actually, of the United States stipulates that they will not tolerate any such alliance taking place on anywhere, any country on the continent of Americas, of the Americas. So it seems that, you know, it's okay for the United States, but not for anybody else. So it's very clear that this war was provoked, not just the Bucharest Declaration. We then saw a coup in Ukraine that was backed by the EU and by the United States. We then saw the regime in Kiev basically declaring war on the Russian-speaking East Ukraine. 14,000 people have lost their lives by the time of the start of the military operation by Russia in 2022. And they completely ignored the efforts by Russia that were put forward in December. A peace and security proposal was just dismissed out of hand by NATO. So there was no need for this war to have taken place, even days before. But if you actually look at the evidence, this war, not just me saying that it was provoked, it's not just things like the Bucharest Declaration. You've got articles in journals like the Atlantic Council talking about the strategic case for risking war with Russia. The US Defense Department even commissioned an inquiry by, a study by the RAND Corporation, looking at how Russia could be weakened. This is about, as Julian Assange talked about, another forever war. It's about weakening Russia in order to balkanize Russia, because there are rich pickings to be had by breaking up Russia. So it's an existential threat to Russia. So little wonder that they responded in the way that they did. And of course, shortly after the war started, it could have been ended. There were peace negotiations, and Boris Johnson was dispatched to scupper those negotiations. So with the war, it's still going on. It's an absolute tragedy for all the people that have been affected by it. And there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal of all publications, I think just a few days ago, talking about the number of Ukrainians who are now amputees as a result of this war. They say the figure is in the order of 50,000 people. That's even higher than the number of amputees in the First World War. What an absolute disgrace. What a shame on these countries which are forcing this war to proceed. So it's crucially important, I think, therefore, that we recognise what this war is about. This is about fossil fuels. It's about plundering Ukraine. I don't know if people saw Zelensky in a virtual way online ringing the bell to open trading at Wall Street and saying there are $400 billion worth of Ukrainian assets now up for grabs. It's disgraceful. And there are no voices, or very few voices. Maybe Jeremy Corbyn is the only one that I can think of who's consistently speaking out against this war in the Palace of Westminster. Where are the voices for peace? Where are our leaders? That's why I say we're being ruled by psychopaths in this country. We need sane voices to prevail. We need peace to prevail. Because people are losing their lives unnecessarily. People are being thrown into Zelensky's meat grinder, which is all it is. People being press ganged on the streets of Ukrainian cities and forced into the Ukrainian military to basically face death and severe injuries, maimed for life. This can't go on. And so it's important that we raise our voices against this madness and call for peace and call on our politicians to actually start to represent us, because in addition to the loss of life in Ukraine that Richard has just spoken about, he also mentioned, of course, the implications and consequences for ordinary people across Europe, with these sanctions blowing back against ordinary people in this country and elsewhere. It's not a madness, and we have to speak up as we're here today, and we need to make sure that we amplify our voices and grow this message of peace And so I think the message needs to go out from here today. Give peace a chance.
Former Labour MP for Derby, Chris Williamson. Actually, he's also the former leader of Derby Council for the Labour Party. I can't imagine him lasting 5 minutes in the modern Labour Party, though, Martin.
Well, he was booted out, wasn't he? And that's happened to quite a lot of people.
Yeah, but anyway, what about what he's saying there? I mean, particularly this point he made about the $400 billion of Ukrainian assets that he's almost like a kind of used car salesman over in the United States giving a speech, Zelensky, saying, we've got $400 billion worth of assets. Come on, invest in me.
Yeah, well, the BlackRock have you know, basically cornered the Ukraine market. And it was always a very corrupt place, Ukraine. I mean, it was very similar to Russia in the 90s, but they never came out of that. The Russians pulled out of that and started to reorganize themselves, but the Ukrainians never did. And at one stage, they weren't allowed, foreigners weren't allowed to buy up farmland in Ukraine, which is one of the assets of West Ukraine. It's one of the few assets they've actually got. But it's all been bought up now by Western multinationals. And, of course, that's one of the reasons why the Russians have attacked the port of Odessa, because those multinationals were making a lot of money through the grain deal, most of which, only 3% of which went to Africa. Most of it went to Western Europe, and some of it went to China. So they won't be able to export anything for now, and they're going to lose quite a lot of money. That's why the Russians have done it. That's what you do in wars.
Can you just explain why this grain deal collapsed? Because the Russians certainly, I was trying to figure this out, and because you're getting a very one-sided view from the you know, the psycho in the corner. So what they're saying is that the Russians just dragged their heels. They didn't really want to cooperate. As far as I can see, there are some quite important clauses in this grain agreement to run the to allow the Ukrainians to get their grain ships from Odessa and out through the Bosphorus to other countries that involved the dropping of sanctions against Russia. And, of course, that never happened. So it's an agreement that the Russians would be fools to go carry on with when the Ukrainians have just simply not kept their side of the bargain, rather like Minsk.
Well, it's exactly like Minsk. Erdogan managed to broker the deal. The Russians are doing their best to, you know, deal with, you know, third parties like the Turks, like the Chinese, like the Saudis, whoever they may be, and the African leadership. They're trying to show that we are prepared to compromise. Yes, I can see we don't want to destabilize the world grain market. We can let them. You know, by agreement, they can export their grain, but you've got to let us export our grain. If the whole idea is to keep the grain market stable so that we don't cause hunger in developing countries, then you've got to let us export our stuff as well. Otherwise, the prices are still going to go up. But the Ukrainians are going to be making that money and we're not going to be allowed to. And they, what they said is you've got to cut the – it's a state-owned bank, the Agricultural Bank of Russia – you've got to put it back in the SWIFT system so that they can, you know, they can do deals with people. And the other thing they've got to do is Russia exports a lot of fertilizer, ammonia fertilizer. And there's actually a pipeline that runs from Russia to the Black Sea through Ukraine to Odessa. And the Ukrainians just blew it up. And of course, this fertilizer is absolutely essential for many African countries. Now, this is in actual fact, most of the Ukrainian grain did not go to the developing world. It was actually mostly going to Western Europe. A lot of it ended up being fed to pigs in Spain, and, you know, very profitable for the Spanish pig farmers, very profitable for the multinationals that control the grain in Ukraine. But it was of no help whatsoever to people in Africa. And the war is causing problems in the developing world because the Russians, who are the main, they supply about 20% of the world's grain, are not being allowed to export their grain. So poor people in Africa are being told, you've got to starve so that we can stop Russian aggression in Europe.
Well, it's a very good way of putting it, Martin. It's a really interesting angle, because this is the sort of thing that the psycho in the corner won't tell us. So thank you very much for sharing that. I did my speech, and don't worry, I'm not going to trouble you with listening to it now. I put it up online last night. And so you can, and I will put all the full versions of these speeches up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. But my speech was really about, it was rather sort of dull in many ways, look through the history of NATO. So I just thought, well, let's look at some of the interesting parts of it and just pick out a couple of those now. And it's a sort of, what I've done is a kind of timeline since NATO was formed in 1949. So there's 1954, which was the first Bilderberg meeting, which is what my book is about, looking at the links between the Bilderberg conferences, which is NATO's political lobby, extremely successful. And as I pointed out on Sunday, we've now got Goldman Sachs representative Rishi Sunak sitting in number 10. And this is, of course, what Bilderberg was trying to do right from the start. And now they've really succeeded, almost totally succeeded, in making sure that pro-NATO, pro-Bilderberg candidates are the only ones allowed to stand any chance of becoming our political leaders. So that was 1954. And then we had in 1966 the rather devastating announcement by the French president, Martin, that that's Charles de Gaulle, that the Americans and NATO were going to be ejected from France. And it happened in the space of a few months. All the US troops were forced, and weapons, etc., were forced to leave France.
Well, that's right. And it was because the OAS, the Organisation Armée Secrète, which was basically the French military, worked with the British and the Americans to try and assassinate de Gaulle. And de Gaulle's security people, who were all been in the resistance with him, they knew exactly what had happened. And they just said to the Americans, "No, you've got to go. Thank you for liberating us from the Nazis. Now it's time to go home."
Now, I thought that was the other way around. I mean, because I mentioned, didn't I, the Day of the Jackal film, which is about the French security services trying to chase an assassin who was trying to assassinate de Gaulle. It's a terrific film, a very, very good, you know, sort of political thriller, really. But I was under the impression that the American hatred for de Gaulle came before he kicked them out. But you're telling me the other way around.
No, the reason why they hated him was two things. Because the French military were opposed to him because they put him in power in 1958 in a military coup, understanding that de Gaulle would therefore prevent any withdrawal from Algeria. But having come to power, de Gaulle turned around a bit like Putin and Berezovsky and said, "No, we're withdrawing from Algeria." So they were very unhappy about that. The Americans were unhappy because he was opposing the Vietnam War. He was just saying, "We got out of Vietnam because we couldn't win, and you need to get out as well. You can't win. It's a waste of time." And, of course, up until 1972, you could get dollars and you could go and trade them for gold. And that's what de Gaulle was doing. As France accumulated dollars, they went straight to the gold window and turned it into gold, which, of course, was basically a way of putting pressure on the Americans to give up fighting in Vietnam. And, of course, the Americans didn't like that. They wanted to fight on in Vietnam. So he's being an awkward customer, so they tried to get rid of him. And, of course, this isn't out there in the mainstream. You know, it's not the sort of thing that your Labour MP will have thought about very much. And, of course, we're in NATO, as we all know, Tony. I mean, all sensible people know we should be in NATO. But, of course, that is not necessarily the case. The French at the time, or the leadership, de Gaulle's leadership, they were willing to say, "Well, you know, we're not playing ball here."
Well, didn't a similar sort of thing?
We don't want that to happen again.
Didn't a similar sort of thing over the colonial possessions happen in Portugal with rather different results? There was a lot of tussle during that period, wasn't it, in the 1960s and 70s, over whether these European powers were going to actually try and hang on to their colonial interests around the world.
Well, that was the Portuguese military coup of 1974 was extremely important. Because the Estado Novo, the Portuguese fascist state, which Salazar had been in power since the 1920s, they had a conscript military, so everybody had to do their 2 years national service fighting in Angola, Mozambique, East Timor, Guinea-Bissau, various places of the Portuguese Empire. And the Portuguese Movimento dos Capitães, the captain's movement, they plotted very, very cleverly. They talked to all of the guerrilla movements they were fighting, and they said, right, well, our plan is we're going to have a military coup in Portugal, and we're going to hand the keys over to of your countries to you. You know, we want you to take over. And it was carried out with extremely skillfully, because they didn't want the Americans to find out what they were going to do. And the Americans and the British were stunned when it happened, because they just presumed that that wouldn't happen. And it caused huge rifts and ructions, because suddenly all of these developing countries, Angola, Mozambique, and all East Timor, they all became independent and very left-wing just overnight. Bang, just like that. And Portugal itself nearly became a socialist state. And this all happened very, very quickly. And the Western deep state was extremely unhappy with what happened. But, of course, they've managed to struggle back from that since then. They don't just give up that easily.
No, they certainly don't. I imagine there were a few eyebrows raised by a certain Mr. Franco over the border too at that.
Well, yes, the French, the Spanish. Well, it one of the things that led to the fall. I mean, Franco died, and of course, Admiral Carrera Blanco was penciled in to be the follow-on dictator, but ETA killed him in a car bomb attack in 1968, so there was no clear alternative. And places in southern Europe like Portugal and Spain and Greece, they don't particularly necessarily see NATO as a positive force, because they were all in NATO. Portugal and Greece were in NATO under military dictatorship. Spain wasn't, but they were very cooperative with NATO. And, these are the people who murdered thousands and thousands of people in those countries. So, you know, people in Eastern Europe gone, oh, it's been terrible to be ruled by the Russians. They killed loads of people. Well, if you lived in those southern European countries, it was NATO who killed loads and loads of people. And people remember, you know, this is their relatives that are in these mass graves.
Yeah, and our little tangent off from the No to NATO rally, I think we'll go now to James SSB, who's writing a book about his family's exploits. He's from, you would call, I suppose, British Africa. Is it Northern Rhodesia and Southern Rhodesia? Martin, what's the difference between the two?
I think that Northern Rhodesia is what we now call Rhodesia, and Southern Rhodesia is what we now call Zambia.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I think.
Is that rings a bell? Yes, he said that he was using the term Southern Rhodesia and Zambia interchangeably, and it did confuse me a little bit. But apparently,
once it became independent, it wasn't called Southern Rhodesia anymore. It was called Zambia.
Right. Okay. So Zambia was the independent name for it. And he's quite an interesting figure, and I'll put the full version of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. James Espey, his uncle Raymond was one of the chiefs in the British Army whose job was to put down the Mau Mau. Now, do you want to say a little bit about that? Because it was extremely controversial, and it's been being revisited over the last few years, Martin, hasn't it?
Yes. There's a very good book by Caroline Elkinson, I think it is. She's an American academic, and it's called Britain's Gulag, and it's about what happened in Kenya during the Mau Mau emergency, as it became known in Britain. And she was pointing out that at the height of the emergency in Kenya, there were far more political prisoners in British hands inside the camp system in Kenya than in the Soviet Union. And, of course, in the Soviet Union, people did survive the camps. They didn't survive in the camps that the British were running. At least, she estimates, 200,000 people were tortured to death. They were castrated, flogged, burned. And that is not Britain in 1857 putting down the Indian Mutiny. That's Britain in 1957 trying to keep hold of Kenya.
And James Espy had some rather interesting stories to tell also about, I think it was his grandmother, who used to deliver telegrams for Cecil Rhodes, lived round the corner from Cecil Rhodes in some big mansion. But anyway, let's have a listen now to James now speaking a little bit about his uncle Raymond, who was one of the chief strategists for the British Army in putting down the Mau Mau.
Well, the empire's gone because suddenly everybody wanted to be independent, right? Now, and people said, look, you've got no right to rule us. We want to be independent. We are our own people. I mean, if you look at Australia, how we murdered people in Tasmania, left, right, and centre, because they were, you know, whatever they were. But that's history. But the point is, Britain, on the other hand, we did a lot of good internationally. You've got to look at the positives. If you look at India today, the largest country in the world population-wise, 1.4 billion people, ignoring that terrible rail accident the other day, we put in the infrastructure for them to run a reasonably civilized society. And the judicial system, the electricity, the roads and road system, we put in structure. If you look at South Africa with rights and wrongs, including the Boers, by the way, there were 9 black tribes fighting and killing each other. We stopped that kind of warfare between the tribes. We've stopped down tribalism. So we did a lot of it, and we brought culture and our version of civilization to nations where life was very cheap. On the other hand, you did as I say, not as I do, kind of thing was our mantra.
Well, okay, so back up to the Mau Mau. When did that start, that conflict, and where exactly was it?
Well, it was in the 50s, and I can't remember it precisely. And I only found out about my uncle when he was 85, because he was very secretive about everything. And he died in England. And, you know, I met him, and my sister and I are writing a book at the moment on the history of our family and 4 generations of Espies of Africa, we will call it probably. And so that's where I met Raymond. And Raymond, I met him a few times in Cape Town, but I never knew what he did. I just knew him as Uncle Raymond. And I found out in the end of his life what he had done. And there was a third uncle, strange enough, who wrote all the mining laws in Northern Rhodesia, and he got an OBE. So it's quite interesting looking into these things for whatever reason, good and bad and ugly.
Okay, well, can you tell us about that Mau Mau conflict?
Well, I didn't know enough about it. Remember, I was a child, so in my days I knew nothing. I had no role in it at all. I just was a student of history. All I knew, there was the Mau Mau, and fighting for independence, for killing, brutalizing everybody. And so it was a vicious warfare. And, and I will find out more, because I'm digging up some, I've got some notes to read about my Uncle Raymond. But end of the day, you know, it was a brutal war, and again, tribalism was right. The Kikuyu was the main tribe, and, you know, tribalism has been a disease. Look, we've got tribalism in the UK up to a point. We've got the Scots and the Welsh tribes, if you like, and we've got 2 Irish tribes, and tribalism feeds on itself. And look what used to happen in Scotland a couple of hundred years ago, when every belonging to whichever tribe you fought and killed each other. So history's full of tribalism, but we've sort of eradicated it, and it's theoretically British, no matter what Nicola Sturgeon thinks. End of the day, you know, we're a British nation, and we're stronger for it. And though we're only 65 million people, I think we have a powerful, disproportionate influence in the world, because we still have some civilized values and structure and legal system that sort of seems to work.
Well, that seems to be kind of crumbling at the moment. But look, what about your Uncle Raymond? Why was, do you think, the struggle so bloody? I mean, it was particularly nasty, wasn't it?
Well, I think because basically the Mau Mau would take no prisoners, and they went around torturing people, killing people, brutalizing farmers. Because remember, they were rightly wrong. There were lots of white farmers who, and you know, if you look, digress a bit. If you go back to Zimbabwe. Now, my father's first cousin, Jack Halliwell, was chairman of Rhodesia Broadcasting Corporation, and he in fact stopped Harold Wilson speaking on television. Would you believe? But I met Ian Smith once. You know, end of the day, the right Ian Smith, after independence, stayed in Rhodesia and invited Mugabe to go for a walk with him in the townships. And Mugabe wouldn't do it, because all that's happened is you've got an autocratic kleptocracy at the top, stealing from everybody below. And suddenly Mugabe, you know, whatever the rights and wrongs were, all these farmers employed lots of people, gave them lives. They took the farms over and pillaged everything, and everyone's starving in Zimbabwe. And Zimbabwe is a tragic case today of a country that was once a net exporter of food. It's a begging bowl now, ruined by politicians. And that's a lot of the problem of Africa.
So that's James Espy there. We look forward to his book coming out, and I'll put the full version of that interview up on our show page, including the bit about Cecil Rhodes and the telegrams. Apparently, they used to use Pitman's shorthand for code, which I don't think would really, this is back in the late 1800s, would really go down as a very good code nowadays. But anyway, what do you make of his take on all that, Martin? This Mau Mau conflict his uncle Raymond was so much involved in took place between 1952 and 1960, and certainly falls into the category of, well, certainly at the time, the British were trying to hang on to these colonial countries, and they were slowly learning the lesson that you're not going to be able to, weren't they?
Well, I mean, he's clearly, if you like, part of the people, you know, the British families that went out to Africa to run it. I mean, he's part of that, you know, he comes out with views which wouldn't be out of line with the kind of things those people believe. He mentioned there about India and what a successful place India is. There's a book by Shashi Tharoor, which I've got in front of me. It's called Inglorious Empire, What the British Did to India. And it's a very, it's actually based on a speech he made at the Oxford Union some years ago now. And in actual fact, educated Indians are able to point out that the British, in fact, de-developed India. India would be a much better place now.
Well, there's a debate, certainly a debate to be had. You can't deny that the British... I'm not saying the British did a good thing, Martin. I mean, he listed... just a minute. He listed things like the British bringing in electricity networks, road networks, rail networks, a judicial system. Obviously, it was a judicial system that the British controlled. But, you know, you can't deny those things, and the water systems too.
If the Mughal Empire had continued, they would have brought that in under Indian control. And they'd be India and China were at one stage far more developed than Britain was. We just turned up with bigger guns. And if the world had been a different place and the British Empire hadn't happened, China and India would be ruling the world right now. But they're not, because they've had to get back from where they were put by us, by the British. The Chinese in particular remember this with great bitterness. And of course, the British have got such a kind of narcissistic view of everything, you know. There's nothing we did wrong.
Well, I think the Oxford Union is probably a good place to do that, because it would be fascinating debate between those suggesting that the British Empire did have some sort of civilizing influence. Obviously, there was a. I mean, I think he's being there reasonably self-effacing there, saying that, you know, basically the whole thing in the Mau Mau struggle was made so horrific because both sides took this attitude of take no prisoners, and that I suppose. And I go back to my original point here, or question to you, which is, do you think that conflict really was the clear message to the British that you're not hanging on to any of these colonial states anymore?
They tried in Yemen.
Well, they failed, didn't they, with the Mau Mau? They failed.
Yes, they did. But the methods that they used, the Mau Mau were terrible. They tortured people. They killed people. The Mau Mau, the founder of the Mau Mau, Stanley Mthenge, was fought with the Chindits in Burma. And when he came back from Burma, having fought the Japanese and learned all of his techniques from Ord Wingate, who went on to form the Israeli army, he said, well, are you going to give us a fair crack of the whip here? This land is our land. You've taken it off us to grow tobacco, but we want to grow food on it. That's what we need to do. And they fought very, very successfully against the British. The British had to put the whole of the Kikuyu tribe, 1.2 million people, were put into these camps. Out of that 1.2 million people in those camps, at least 200,000 were tortured to death. I mean, in recent times, two of them actually came to Britain and won some compensation in the High Court here for being castrated, because British soldiers castrated them. And, of course, there's
Martin, you know, in the Mau Mau conflict, the same sort of things went on both sides, didn't they?
The Mau Mau, the main conflict was within the Kikuyu tribe, between those who were, from a Mau Mau point of view, traitors, because they were on the side of the British. And so it was an internecine fight. And ultimately, of course, Barbara Castle took up the cause of what was going on in these camps in Kenya. All of the records were destroyed. Caroline Elkins has done a very good job of unearthing what's left and talking to people. Her book was devastating when it came out about a decade ago, because the British had admitted maybe 11,000 people had died in this emergency in Kenya, and she said it's more like 250,000. and it was deliberate as well. They were deliberately tortured to death.
Those figures are disputed. I mean, officially...
They are disputed, but they're not disputed. There's nobody believes there is only 11,000 people died.
Martin, can I just finish what I'm saying? You do interrupt a little bit too much. You must let me finish sentences occasionally. There were roughly 3,000 native Kenyan police and soldiers killed, and estimates up to 20,000 Kenyans killed. So we're talking there around 25,000 people altogether. So, I mean, I think, you know, there are... That I don't know where that Caroline gets her figures from.
Disputed, Tony. That's why Caroline Elkins...
Officially, there were only 12,000 killed.
Yes, she's saying that was a hell of a lot more than that, and all the records...
Well, 25,000 is a hell of a lot more. So, let's not say that Caroline has got the definitive figure. There are a range of figures around from an official figure, which we don't really agree with, right the way up to hers.
Yeah, the point she was making, don't forget the Mau Mau didn't call themselves the Mau Mau. That was what the British called them. They called themselves the Land and Freedom Army. And, of course, because of all this brutality in these camps, Barbara Castle cut her teeth as a young Labour MP investigating all of this. And the British had to release Kenyatta from prison and hand over the country to him. And the deal was that he would... get to come to power, Kenya would get independence, but nobody would ever be prosecuted for anything that happened in these camps. And that's what happened. Of course, Kenyatta wasn't actually Mau Mau, and many of the people who fought for the Mau Mau resented the fact that he came to power and they did all the suffering and dying. And it's all in Elkington's book. And, she's well thought of in the people who understand things about African history. And also what's happened in Rhodesia, that was it's not been well managed in Rhodesia since independence, but that's not been helped by the fact that the IMF has slapped sanctions on Zimbabwe. They also, the IMF told them to sell off all of the grain that they'd stored for famine years. And there's all sorts of things have gone on there. And of course, there's just a self-seeking, even now, if you talk to people who Daily Mail readers in this country, they've still got the idea that basically the British Empire was okay, we didn't do that much trouble, and what we're seeing now, of course, with we're going round to our former colonies like India and Zimbabwe and Kenya and saying, well, you are going to support us against Putin, aren't you? And they're going, no, we're not.
Well, her more recent book is called Caroline Elkins. More recent book is called Legacy of Violence: A History of the British Empire. And I would try and balance this out a bit. I'm no gung-ho, flag-waving British Empire fan at all. But, you do meet people, particularly elderly Indians. And I met someone from Somaliland whose father was a big fan of Britain. He was saying, well, actually, when the British were occupying Somaliland, it was great. We remember it as kids. You know, everything sort of seemed to work. Now it's a total nightmare. And, of course, that was deliberate. And I think this is the adjunct to all of this discussion, is that when these bits of empire were given up by the Portuguese, by the Dutch, by whoever, actually what was really going on there was a financial oligarchy, kind of Fourth Reich was starting to take over, and any leaders that came forward who were really organised, sorted out, understood the way the world worked, were assassinated.
That's right. All over, Kwame Nkrumah talked about neocolonialism in his book written in the early 60s, and then he was overthrown by the Americans. Patrice Lumumba was murdered by the Americans. 30,000 people in Argentina were tortured to death by the military government. These were the people who might have been able to run the society.
Well, we've sort of strayed off from looking at the French and their colonial empire and Charles de Gaulle kicking the NATO forces, the Americans, basically out of France back in 1966. They only came in relatively recently back into NATO, Martin, didn't they, under Sarkozy? That was, I'm just looking here, 2009. So they spent nearly 50 years out of the alliance, the French.
Well, they were still in the NATO command structure, but they didn't have any bases. They got all US bases out of France.
Well, hang on. Apparently, France is still out of NATO's nuclear command structure.
That's right.
they will have nothing to do with it. So, you know, you can't tell a French general to launch a nuclear strike if you're an American. You can, I suppose, with the British. Anyway, just moving on, one of the things that was important, I think, to mention in Whitehall on Sunday is Operation Gladio. We've spent quite a lot of time pulling this one apart, Martin, haven't we? And we're going to hear now, this is in the 1980s, we're going to hear now a clip about that because I came across Danny Alleganza, who was one of the first people's books I read about Gladio, was called NATO's Secret Armies. And Ganser is a Swiss academic that almost kind of wrote this book sitting on a mountaintop, cross-legged, watching these various shenanigans going on during the Second World War, after the Second World War, and NATO. And so here he is talking about the trial at the Piazza Fontana. Now, this was one of the first, I believe, explosions that were carried out by NATO, by NATO intelligence, by their fascist operatives. And the attempt was to blame this on communists, Martin. So maybe you can say something about, before we hear the clip, about Piazza Fontana.
Well, in 1969, there were two bombs in the Banco Agricola in Milan. The first one had been planted by the Italian secret services, and it was time to go off in the middle of the night when there would be nobody there, and it was going to be blamed on anarchists. But the Italian secret services had themselves been infiltrated by MI6 and the CIA, and they planted another bomb, which was designed to go off when people were in there doing business, and nine people died. There was a police investigation into it. There's a very good film.
Sorry, there. Can I just start to tell you, was this on the same day or what?
No, the what they're doing is, the two bombs. So the police at first said, why are the two bombs here? Yeah. So that was the first question they had to ask. Why are the two bombs here? And then they started to unravel it. And the police inspector who investigated all of this was ultimately assassinated. There's a very good drama documentary about this, made in Italy in 2016. If people want to know the full detail about what happened at Piazza Fontana. And, of course, they ultimately kidnapped, NATO intelligence services kidnapped Aldo Moro, the prime minister of Italy, and murdered him in order to prevent the Communist Party of Italy, the PCI, Partito Comunista Italiano, from having a share of power in Italy. And at one stage, it was thought that it was only in Italy that all these things went on. The senior judge in Italy, Imposimato, wrote a book which came out in 2012, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, based on all the police investigations into NATO intelligence services. You know, the James Bonds, MI6, those people. They killed hundreds of people in Italy. They killed loads of people in Belgium and various other places around Europe. And, of course, they also carried out the massacre in the Maidan Square in 2014, as we know from the court case in Kyiv in 2017. But you talk to Keir Starmer about this or Rishi Sunak and they will look at you blankly because they don't know anything about it. They live in a different world where none of this actually happened and they don't know anything about
it. Well, it hasn't even been deleted from Starmer's hard drive, has it? It just never was uploaded.
That's right. I think sometimes you've got some politicians who know what went on, Italian politicians. You know, Andreotti, who used to be the prime minister, actually admitted in Parliament, yes, well, we did do all of that, but it was necessary. But what you've got in Britain is people who just, they don't know this stuff.
I think it's a willful blindness there as well, where people just simply don't want to know. It doesn't fit their narrative, and so they're not taking any notice of it.
That's right. Keir Starmer is very, very pro-NATO. He makes a big deal out of being pro-NATO. You say, well, the NATO that blew up the Bologna railway station, that NATO. Oh, I don't believe they did that. They did. The Italian police have proved it. But everybody just shrugs their shoulders and moves on.
Well, as Daniela Ganser
tells
us and quotes from it extensively in his book, NATO's Secret Armies, there were actually three parliamentary inquiries into this NATO terrorist group that was trying to blow up. Well, it was blowing up many. I think it is something like 1,000 Italians. But anyway, look, we'll just say a little brief thing about the Bologna railway station bomb carried out by NATO in Italy. After we hear from Daniela Ganser here being interviewed for the Mind Renewed podcast about this bank bombing in Milan, the Piazza Fontana that Martin was just discussing there.
We have one general, it's Giandelio Maletti, he's former head of the Italian Counterintelligence Unit, and he said in 2001 at the Piazza Fontana trial, he actually said, you know, American terrorism is a reality in Europe, and it's scary what he said. He said, the CIA, following the directives of its government, wanted to create an Italian nationalist capable of halting what it saw a slide to the left. And for this purpose, it may have made use of right-wing terrorism. That's his quote. And, you know, he was a member of the Italian Secret Service, and he obviously was accused, you know, by Italians who said, why do you carry out terrorism against our mothers and against our children, against our the elderly in the country? Are you insane? You know, you should be in prison. And he said, come on, I'm not the one to blame. I mean, I'm acting in a global network. And he said, you know, at the time when Nixon was in charge, and Nixon, you know, wanted to fight communism, and he may have made use of right-wing terrorism. That's how Maletti says it. And for us as historians, it's very hard to find out what the truth is. I mean, in 1969, when this terrorist attack occurred, I wasn't even born. So I'm looking at the data, and I'm trying to figure out who fooled whom.
Well, the fact of the matter is much of this has been buried, hasn't it, really, Martin? It's kind of taboo, certainly in the mainstream press. Apart from this series, Time Watch, three-part series, made by Alan Frankovich, who died not long afterwards. In fact, he made a brilliant documentary about the Lockerbie bombings, too, called The Maltese Double Cross. But do you want to just go on to say something a little bit about the later bombing by NATO in Italy, the Bologna railway station?
Well, that happened in 1980, killed 87 people. You've got to remember that Bologna was a big stronghold for the PCI, the Communist Party of Italy. So the right wing who bombed Bologna railway station are basically killing communist voters. It was blamed on the left, but it patently wasn't the left that did it. And it wasn't just the fascists either. It was part of the strategia di tensione, the strategy of tension, by the CIA working with the mafia and the British. The British had their fingerprints all over this. In the supermarket massacres, the Brabant supermarket massacres in Belgium in the 1980s, we understand from investigations that were taking place that it was British special forces who killed lots of people in supermarkets in Belgium. And, you know, the chat we had on earlier going on about how wonderful the British Empire was, and it wasn't that all that
I don't
bad.
Know. I don't think he was quite so.
Well, he was
teasing out some of the positive points amongst he's a bit of a warts and all guy, actually. He's saying, look, lots of things we did wrong.
I bet you he doesn't know anything that we're talking about here, though, does he?
Well, it's not his field. It's not his field, is it? He's in Africa. He's writing about Africa.
Yes, I know, but I mean, there's plenty of people in British politics who haven't got a clue about any of this as well. I tell you who does understand it, the Russian foreign services. They understand it all because they knew at the time what was going on, and they know now. They know exactly what they're dealing with in NATO intelligence services, which is why they're doing such a good job of mopping them up.
So that sort of winds up our section on the No to NATO rally. I would very much advise people to either follow them on Twitter, take a look at the website, on Facebook, etc., because there's some fascinating people, as we heard from Neil McRae, all sorts of academics and stuff are coming together as part of this anti-NATO alliance. It may be that the Ukraine war will bring together a new party. We were hearing, weren't we, from Chris Williamson, or not, it wasn't actually from him, it was the lady that was introducing him, about his new party. I think, is it called the New People's Party? Anyway, what I'll do is I will look that up right now. But anyway, we're going to, just before the break, we're going to hear from Wales. There's been some news stories this week, Martin. I mean, I didn't know Mark Drakeford, he's the First Minister of Wales, and he's saying that the road connecting the North and South Wales, which has been being planned for many years, I mean, obviously, anyone that tries to drive from North to South Wales finds it very difficult. Even on the train, it's pretty awkward, very sort of long, takes ages. And I remember winding back from Llandudno back to Bristol via all these little tiny little towns forever going through Wales. But they're talking about a bit like the M4 or the Heads of the Valley Road down in South Wales, to have a road running up up and down. But no, he's Drakeford is saying most definitely he doesn't want that. Then he's also I didn't realise this, Martin, but his son is a paedophile and a rapist, and he has finished his prison sentence, but he breached his order whilst living up in North Wales. His name is Jay Humphreys, previously named Jonathan Drakeford. He's been relocated to Bangor after his release from prison, but then he kept breaching all these orders, making sure he didn't continue offending. But the reason I'm mentioning Drakeford is because he's announced this week that he's not going to be standing again. What do you make of the Labour Party of Wales, Martin?
Well, they've got a distinct identity separate from the Labour Party in England. They always have had, really. And they see themselves as independent of London in certain attitudes that they take. They are in coalition, as you know, at the moment with Plaid Cymru. And because of the change in the electoral system in Wales, the Tories still have quite a substantial vote in Wales, but they're never going to run anything because the electoral system doesn't, you know, they can't find any allies, basically.
You probably find that would be the same even if it was first past the post over there.
Well, that's right. That's Wales for you.
Yeah, it's Wales for you.
In Scotland, of course, there is still a substantial Tory vote in parts of Wales.
I spoke earlier this week, in fact, earlier today, to Neil Mackay. It's the Eisteddfod this weekend. Have you ever been to that?
No, I haven't.
But it's a pretty amazing cultural event. They're starting to get very strict on no English. So if it's a performance going on at the Eisteddfod, and that's where Neil McAvoy, former member of the Senedd and a sort of this show's Welsh correspondent, I suppose you could call him. But anyway, I thought it'd be interesting to ask him what the state of Welsh politics is now that we're being told that this guy, Mark Drakeford, whose son is a convicted paedophile and rapist and is breaking his, you know, he's actually a pretty horrific criminal, and he's standing down. What's the state of the Welsh politics? And also, I asked him a bit about Welsh independence.
Neil McAvoy, leader of Propel. I'm elected to Cardiff County Council. Not a great deal of change, really. I think, you know, they've got elections out of the way, so we're seeing some pretty dreadful policies being implemented in local government in Wales. Clearly, the, you know, 20 miles an hour as well is a massive issue. 15-minute cities without the services and without the transport, without the public transport. Anyway, we're seeing huge cuts announced in buses in Cardiff. So, I mean, it's very contradictory where you're not allowed to use the car or will be fined for using the car, it seems, and yet they've taken off buses.
Labour, we had Crispin Flintoff from Not the Andrew Marr Show on last week, Neil, and Labour looking incredibly authoritarian. Also, Drakeford saying he's not going to be standing. I mean, as I understood it, you know, people just carried on if they were successful, and he's decided to step down. Is it likely that you think that Plaid will be in charge when the election's next year?
Not a hope. I mean, the main thing with Plaid Cymru is that they have no interest in actually winning elections. They expelled most of the core activists lots of core activists challenging Labour, like me, for example, and they openly worked with Drakeford to make sure that he retained his seat. It was really weird when I was in Plaid, being in a party which was not supporting me, not supporting local people, but actually supporting the opposition person. Because what you have in Welsh politics, a deal is done in the Senedd, deals done behind closed doors, and it doesn't even get on the chamber floor. I mean, everything's done through the business committee, which nobody ever sees. Labour is incredibly authoritarian. So is Plaid Cymru. So are the Liberal Democrats in Wales. There's a real issue with restrictions on choice, restrictions on liberty, and it's sort of like communism, but without the without the idea of any kind of egalitarianism. There's very much a new elite in Wales, which has been created, sadly, by devolution. very nasty, nasty kind of...
Yeah, mixed with all this is actually a lot of poverty. I was in Newport.
Oh, huge.
Newport this week, and, I mean, there's a load of people. I was actually just chatting to someone whose daughter has now bought a house in Newport, and both her and her husband are commuting over the bridge to Bristol every day because the actual house prices there are affordable, whereas when you go over to England, they're not. So what's going on with... I'm on the side of poverty. I mean, where are the opportunities for young people in Wales?
Pretty good question. I mean, the opportunities for young people in Wales are very limited. I mean, if I had my time again now as a youngster, would I stay in Wales? I think I'd probably consider leaving, to be honest. The issue is that Labour profits through people's poverty. They've got the Praetorian Guards, if you like, in the so-called third sector, which is a... It's two kind of name. The third sector are private companies calling themselves charities, massively overpaying senior managers. And if you look at the structure of these organisations in Wales, so many are run by Labour Party members, prominent Labour Party members. So many are run by supporters. And it's a conveyor belt of an easy life, really, in terms of income. And you get people earning £90,000 a year from the public sector, because we pay for it, it's all taxpayers' money. They wouldn't have a hope of earning half of that in the private sector. So there's a real conveyor belt of a poverty industry in Wales, and Labour profits from it. I mean, you know, they profit from denying opportunity, and the key thing is it's trying to wake people up, and I think, you know, therein lies the challenge, really. The Conservatives, Lib Dems, Plaid Cymru, Labour, they really are all the same once you get into Welsh politics. And the challenge with Papel and other people like Glad is just breaking through, really. We're limited by budget, I suppose, would be the main thing, and media coverage.
Yeah, limited by money and media coverage. It's starting to sound like the United States, but it's quite clearly a duopoly in charge in the Senedd in Cardiff, Martin, just like in London, you know, this kind of agreement of the Labour Party under Starmer to just kind of abstain on key civil liberties votes that the Tories want to push through. A similar thing going on between Plaid Cymru and Labour. And whilst there are people like Propel or parties like Propel with Neil, and there's small parties, and he is now, he's a county councillor, he said, there isn't really any way for them to break through. And this is where I would definitely agree with you on the first-past-the-post system. It makes it very difficult for anyone to get through, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, changing the electoral system is a necessary but not sufficient condition for, good outcomes. Obviously, because the Labour Party has been so strong in Wales for so many generations, they do become complacently, you know, they are the establishment. And, of course, what's possible for somebody like Neil McEvoy is, because you do have proportional elections to the Welsh Assembly, he can start to make progress. If it was first past the post and there was no Assembly, he wouldn't have any chance whatsoever. So I do appreciate somebody like him saying, you know, he's an insider. He's been a member of both Labour Party and Plaid Cymru. He probably knows quite a lot about how it actually runs. But he's able to found a new party and try and take the system on, because the rules allow it. Even then, it's not going to be very easy, because, as he says, he's got no money and the media is under the control of the people with the money. So it's very difficult to communicate, even when you've got something to say. Politics is about struggles, and everywhere, Wales as well.
Yep, certainly is. Anyway, we'll be back after the break, looking at, well, various bits and bobs, but certainly the anniversary of the dropping of the two nuclear bombs. We'll be hearing from our dearly departed Manfred Petrich about the Nazi contribution to those bombs, because his father was a Nazi who worked at the BMW jet engine factory developing the jet engine in World War II for the Messerschmitt 262 aircraft. And he knew a lot of Nazis. He knew a lot about what had happened with a lot of the technology, and some of it found its way to the United States, particularly for the second of the two atomic bombs, the one that was dropped on Nagasaki, not Hiroshima. But we'll also be hearing from a Dutch correspondent, Jungle Bus Millie. She worked in the newsroom in Holland back in the 1970s and witnessed the Lockheed scandal, which saw Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, the chairman of the Bilderberg Group, booted out unceremoniously, I'm afraid, booted out of his job. So that's after the break, and we'll also be asking Martin to give us his comments on the assassination. I mean, this is a particularly horrific assassination, and hardly covered actually here in the Western press, of one of the main electoral candidates for Ecuador in the Ecuadorian presidential elections.
Thank you. For his good works, hast numbered the blessed Bishop Swithin among thy saints. Grant in thy mercy that we who celebrate these festivities in his memory may also follow the example of his life, through Jesus Christ our Lord.
Amen.
O gracious and holy Father, give us wisdom to perceive thee, diligence to seek thee, patience to wait for thee, eyes to behold thee, a heart to meditate upon thee, and a life to proclaim thee, through the power of the Spirit of Jesus Christ our Lord.
Amen.
Almighty God, who hast given us grace at this time with one accord to make our common supplications unto thee, and dost promise that when two or three are gathered together in thy name, thou wilt grant their requests. Fulfill now, O Lord, the desires and petitions of thy servants, as may be most expedient for them, granting us in this world knowledge of thy truth, and in the world to come, life everlasting.
Amen.
God give you grace to follow his saints in faith and hope and love. And the blessing of God Almighty, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit be amongst you and remain with you, now and always.
Chef there from 1996, 16-bit suicide. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. You heard first there Johann Sebastian Bach's a little bit from the St. Matthew's Passion. And there is, I think, a very obvious way to start, Martin, which is with the assassination over in Ecuador. I mean, this has been just a kind of blip on the news, very little elsewhere. We've also seen the arrest and imprisonment of Imran Khan. So some big things going on the international scene, which don't seem to be getting a lot of coverage in our press. But maybe we could start with Ecuador. And here is a report on the presidential candidate in Ecuador from Al Jazeera.
Presidential candidate Fernando Villavicencio was gunned down in Quito after a political rally just 10 days before general elections.
As soon as he got out, it took him around 30 seconds to get to the door and shooting started. I think it was more than 30 shots. We tried to find where Fernando was, and at that point we realized he had been taken to the hospital. He was shot several times, and in the head.
Villavicencio was surrounded by his bodyguards and political allies. Authorities say at least 9 people were injured. The president has announced 3 days of national mourning and declared a state of exception.
From this moment, the armed forces have been mobilized countrywide to ensure the safety of citizens, peace, and the free and democratic elections of August 20.
Police detained one of the suspects in the attack. He died apparently as a result of his injuries. The Attorney General says another 6 people have been arrested. A drug trafficking gang known as Los Lobos has claimed responsibility. Villavicencio's party members say he had received death threats.
He received death threats many times, not just once. He said, "I'm not afraid, I'm not afraid." Members of the movement told him he needed to wear a flak jacket, but he said nothing will happen.
The 59-year-old led the Build Ecuador movement. A former journalist, he exposed political corruption at the highest level, including former President Rafael Correa, who was convicted and is in hiding. Opinion polls suggest that Villavicencio would have made it to the runoff election.
Everything seems to indicate it was a plot. It appears to have been planned, and today we are paying the consequences. Where is the security in this country if a man who has fought for more than 20 years, who was the best candidate to win, is this the way elections are won in Ecuador?
Ecuador is experiencing some of its worst violence in recent history, caused by organized crime and drug trafficking. It spilled over into the electoral process. 3 weeks ago, a congressional and a mayoral candidate were also killed while campaigning. Despite the insecurity, the National Electoral Council says the vote will go ahead as planned on August the 20th. Mariana Sanchez, Al Jazeera.
So, yes, the actual guy who was shot dead, his name is Ferdinando Villavicencio, and Mark Martin is an investigative journalist, sort of somebody like you or I, who's decided, look, you know, I'm going to stand for president, one of the best candidates in the running, and quite clearly he wouldn't have been assassinated if he didn't stand a chance of becoming the president of Ecuador.
Well, I'm afraid this kind of story is all too common in Latin America. Ecuador itself had a left-of-centre government when Correa was in charge, but Correa was forced out, supposedly for corruption, and of course this guy was supposedly exposing that corruption, but it wasn't for corruption, really. It's because he didn't toe the line for the United States. And of course it was Correa that gave Julian Assange asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy, and then it was his second-in-command, Lenin Moreno, who is the current president, who rescinded that asylum and allowed Assange to be Julian to be captured and put in Belmarsh prison. And of course, Ecuador has a very big lithium potential. And when there was a coup against, I'm mixing it up with Bolivia. Bolivia is the one with the lithium potential. We need to know more about all of this. In fact, the Western media picking up on this particular assassination, as opposed to all sorts of other. In Colombia, people are assassinated.
Well, they haven't really picked up on it much, Martin. I got that from Al Jazeera. There's been very little coverage of this in the London media. Quito, this is what Reuters are saying, that the suspects are Colombian. The police in Quito are reporting they're from Colombia. This Los Lobos drug gang, well, that could be the Central Intelligence Agency, maybe.
Well, it could be. This requires investigation. It was Colombians, if you remember, that assassinated the Prime Minister of Haiti. I'm afraid violence of this kind is endemic across Latin America because of the control that the United States seeks to preserve there. That's their little empire. And, of course, the illegal drugs market, which is set up by the CIA, is a key destabilizing factor. And, of course, some of the left leadership in Latin America are talking in terms of we're going to have to legalize coca, for example. That's exactly what was being said in Bolivia when Morales was in charge. But the Americans are determined to prevent development of, you know, socialist-inclined governments in Latin America. And they used to get rid of them through military coups, but there are all sorts of other techniques for getting your own way.
Well, like sticking them in prison, for example. That seems to be quite also very, very, I think, isn't it Brazil that's been doing this over the last 5 or 10 years? Candidate that's not liked, let's put them in jail.
Lula and Dilma, yeah. But, they've got very... I mean, and of course, just killing people is a very effective way of shutting them up, you know. And
it also has an effect on everyone else. But, you know, right, yeah,
effect, doesn't it?
I'm quite sure what Ferdinando would say is, well, now at least we know, because he's given it his best go at this and died as a result. But this sends a very clear message to the public about who's really in charge. And I don't think there's many people in Ecuador that thinks that the CIA and the Americans weren't involved in this.
Well, I don't understand entirely the politics of it, Tony, It's reprehensible.
Having spent some time in Latin America, the general feeling is that amongst the general population and much of the intelligentsia, that this is a little bit of a playground backyard for the Americans.
Well, the Monroe Doctrine is that the Americans won't allow anybody else to do anything in Latin America without their permission. And because they're losing power in the Middle East, they're losing power in Ukraine, Latin America is in the firing line. This kind of political assassination happens all the time in Mexico, all the time. And the president of Mexico, AMLO, López Obrador, he made a speech, I don't know, several months ago now in the Zocatala, which is the central plaza of Mexico City, where he said, we're not going to be bullied around by the Americans, by the oligarchy in our own country. And by the way, you blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, didn't you? Which is causing huge problems all over the world. And he said it to their face.
The Guardian's reporting, crime and politics have become entwined in Ecuador, which sits sandwiched between the world's two biggest cocaine exporters. Who are they? I suppose one's Colombia. What's the other one?
Venezuela,
okay. Anyway, Villavicencio had vowed to root out corruption and expose the links between politics and organised crime. Wow. That sounds like a global mission. Let's have a global party of people doing that job, because it's absolutely the most important job, really, in the modern world. And quoting his wife, my husband was murdered because he was the only one who stood up to the political mafia and drug traffickers in this country. His widow, Veronica Suarez, who was returning to the country from the United States. Villavicencio leaves behind five children. He'd previously reported receiving multiple death threats, including from the jailed leader of the Choneros gang, Jose Adolfo Macias. So even in jail, they're quite able to send death threats and possibly even order assassinations of politicians over in Ecuador. This is the embassy that Julian Assange was taking refuge in. Everything seems to have gone bad over there.
Well, Correa was a solid leftist president. He couldn't I think he couldn't stand because he'd won twice. And so Lenin Moreno was then brought in as his deputy. I think it was movement towards socialism or whatever. And the allegations against Correa, to my mind, were specious. He wasn't corrupt in the way that this chap was suggesting. It's possible, I don't know the full ins and outs of this, it's possible that he was the pro-US candidate in this particular contest. So it may be that the West is not happy about him being assassinated because he was their candidate. I don't know. I haven't looked into it.
Well, Ecuador is definitely descending into mafia chaos. But also, this is a similar, although not dead yet, Imran Khan. I mean, he was actually, after he'd been elected the president of Pakistan. I mean, can you maybe say something about, because the Americans are particularly interested in Pakistan, Martin, aren't they? And the evidence has come out. I'm just looking up the quotes here about the secret Pakistan cable documents, The Intercept. Glenn Greenwald and people like that have been digging this stuff out. US pressure to remove Imran Khan. All will be forgiven, said a US diplomat, if the no confidence vote against Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan succeeds. This is the 9th of August. Yesterday, a couple of days ago, the US State Department encouraged the Pakistan government in a March the 7th, 2022 meeting to remove Imran Khan as Prime Minister over his neutrality on the Russian invasion of Ukraine. According to a classified Pakistani government document obtained by The Intercept. So this isn't from this week, and Khan has been jailed this week. So what do you make of that whole situation?
Well, Khan was removed by the military in Pakistan under US pressure. The US didn't want him to stand, and now he won't be able to stand in the next election, and he may be dead before the time the election after that comes around. And this is the way US rules the world. We've got all these independent countries, right? They've all become independent of the British
independent Empire. Country of Ukraine. Yes.
Well, yes, except that they are in fact run by mafias based in the deep state in the West, and you know, Britain has also got implications in all of this. We were the lead agency on Operation Cyclone, the most well-funded secret operation in history, funded by heroin, and that brought the Mujahideen to power in Afghanistan. That was us.
And it's the Electoral Commission, Election Commission of Pakistan, which has brought these prosecutions, but I imagine egged on by the Americans. He's not allowed to stand for 5 years in politics. But, I mean, these are trumped-up charges. It's funny using the word because, we had the same about Donald Trump last week.
You see, Correa in Ecuador was removed in very similar circumstances, lawfare rather than warfare.
Yeah, or a judicial coup.
Getting rid of people they don't want.
Yeah. I mean, and of course, it's a nuclear power, Pakistan. Maybe that's why the Americans are so interested.
Well, they are interested in the fact that they've got nuclear weapons, for sure. I tell you who's really interested in that is the Israelis, because they see the Pakistanis as a potential threat because they've got nuclear weapons.
Well, let's have a listen now, anyway, to an Al Jazeera interview, which was done with Imran Khan just before he was jailed.
What is behind all this? The PDM and the establishment, they are petrified of elections. Why are they petrified? Because every survey says PTI will get two-thirds majority the moment there are elections. Now, to avoid elections, even before this, they had 145 cases on me, criminal cases. A man who's known in this country for 50 years had never had one case, criminal case, just in 4 or 5 months, 150 criminal cases. Why? To get me out of the race, get me disqualified. Two assassination attempts, one where I got shot, then there was I almost got killed in another attempt in the judicial complex in Islamabad. So why? It's to get me out of the race. So if you understand the reasoning by what is going on right now, the establishment and the PDM parties, then you will know they use this as a pretext to actually crush PTI. How can they have found the 7,500 PTI workers were involved? Have they any evidence? Most of them have not even been produced in a court of law. They've just conducted a reign of terror, breaking people's houses, walking in the middle of the night. Anyone whose PTI has been attacked by the security agencies.
Independent analysts say that there is a pattern to what happens in Pakistan. Whoever is in government says they're on the same page, as you did when you were in power. Now the people who are in power say they're hand in glove with the military establishment. The relationship has never been better as it is now. And when they come in the opposition, they accuse the party in power of taking them out of politics.
Look, two different things now. Never, in my 3.5 years of power, can you tell me of any incidents like what has been happening to us for 1 year?
The PMLN was cracked down on. The television screens were not allowed to air their interviews. Their leadership was rounded up, including their women as well. This is what they're saying on television screens.
It is just such a bunch of lies. First of all, during our time, there were only 5% of the cases against them. 95% of corruption cases against the PML leadership was from their own time. Remember, Isaac Dar ran away when it was PML government. Nawaz Sharif's two sons ran away from Pakistan during their government.
You allowed Nawaz to leave, though.
No. But first of all this 95% of the corruption cases were when we inherited them. Nawaz went during our time, but unfortunately, you know, we didn't realize that his reports were all doctored. We thought he wouldn't survive a day. You know, we were told in the cabinets. Anyway, what I'm saying is that you cannot even think of comparing what has happened to us in the last 1 year as opposed to what happened to them. I mean, when Nawaz Sharif was only, why was he banned? Because he was convicted by the Supreme Court. He lied that he was ill. He left the country. A convict leaves the country, absconds from justice. And that's, he was making speeches from London. That's when the courts took a decision. Why have I been banned? What? I've not even been convicted of one thing. I mean, these are all allegations. So I'm banned from television. They can't show any of my live addresses. My senior leadership, everyone is now lumbered with cases. All our time is spent from going from one court to the other to get bail. This never happened with PML.
So Nasir Imran Khan, now jailed and banned from 5 years from politics, but still alive. I suppose we should all count him lucky to still be alive. His party is the Pakistan Justice Movement, and officially, Martin, he really should be the president of the country.
Well, I think it's a prime minister, isn't it? It's a prime ministerial system.
Oh, sorry. He should be prime minister. That's what I mean. Yeah, he was prime minister, and he was, booted out by the Americans.
I mean, we had Farouk Sadiq on our show some weeks ago, if you remember, and he was giving us a pretty good rundown of the situation in Pakistan. Imran Khan has emerged as the major critic of the sort of feudal structure in Pakistan, which, you know, big landowners still dominate the government, and the army, of course, is fundamental, and of course the army is allied with the Americans and the British, which is why, incidentally, Rishi Sunak and Joe Biden have said nothing about the imprisonment of Imran Khan. It's not the sort of thing that they want to get involved in. It's an internal matter for the Pakistanis, even if, as the CIA orchestrate the military to get rid of him. In the West, we are given, you know, there are certain people we're supposed to dislike and hate and not have any time for, and there are others who are persecuted, and we just don't say anything about it because, let's face it, you know, they're not on our side.
And I bet you BBC Sport are under orders as well not to say anything about Imran Khan. It's pretty disgusting the way these people are just, their plight is just completely ignored most of the time. So he's got 3 years in jail and 5 years banned from politics. I suppose that means the idea is that when it comes to the next elections in Pakistan, that his political ban will be lifted just before the elections, and so he won't really be able to be a contender in those elections. But I mean, they're kicking the can down the road here, aren't they? And what do you think is the future for Pakistan without Khan?
Well, he's still there as we speak. He's being sent to prison, but he's still there. He's quite elderly, so it's possible that by the time there's another election, he might be dead just through natural causes. Well, people die, Tony. And if you want to get rid of
them, they get poisoned in jail too sometimes.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, prison conditions get perfect conditions for somebody to have a nasty accident, aren't there? You know, that's perfectly feasible. And there have been two attempts on his life already. You know, he's just been lucky. I think what Farouk was talking about is that a younger generation in Pakistan, don't forget it's quite a young country.
He's 71 years old, yeah.
Yeah, but Pakistan itself is quite a young country. It's got lots of young people in it, you know. They've woken up as a result of everything that's happened, and that even if Imran Khan goes, there's going to be a change of attitude at the grassroots about allowing the army and the West to run the country. I mean, it's in Pakistan's interest to join the Belt and Road Initiative. The Chinese are planning to put a massive railway and road system in to Pakistan so they can link up with the port at Gwadar, which will allow the Chinese to import and export without having to come through the Malacca Strait. It's a very, very strategic thing for the Chinese. The Russians, when he was removed from power, he'd just come back from meeting with Putin, Imran Khan, and he was saying, well, we're not going to line up with the West against you. What we want to do is do some deals on grain and fuel.
Yeah, well, there is going to be some sort of appeal with Khan. Watch this space, I suppose, as usual, with these things. I just find it very annoying that there's so little coverage of what is clearly a very important matter for a lot of British, not, I was going to say resident citizens, you know, of Pakistani origin, follow this very, very closely.
Well, Craig Murray's got a very good article on Consortium News about this. And there's, you know, I mean, obviously this document has come out where the US ambassador is basically ordering the Pakistanis to get rid of Khan. that's how the way the world works.
Right, so let's move on now to look at our other main feature this week, which is to do with, well, we'll be doing nukes and Nazis right at the end, but this is with Jungle Bus Millie, that's how she likes to be known, and I spoke to her earlier this week about Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, but also we had quite a wide-ranging discussion about Holland. I mean, we like to think of Holland as quite a libertarian place. She disagrees. She thinks Britain is far better.
In between the First and the Second World War is the wool market, the Wall Street stock market crash, the crash of 1929 that brought about the Great Depression. And my grandpa, for example, my paternal grandpa, he became unemployed and he was literally picked up off the street by the Dutch authorities for being poor, for bringing down the tone of the country. And he was transported to a work camp. And my grandma and her children didn't know where he was for a long time. It's just for being poor, you know, just go be in the east of the country where nobody sees you.
Yeah, I suppose the lesson from this is that we must beware of any kind of, mass economic problems, because literally this creates a kind of red carpet for the next dictator in the future. But anyway, just going back to your journalism, what about Bernhard then?
So, I worked, I grew up in the city of Rotterdam, and my very first journalism job was as an apprentice journalist, literally it was straight out of school when I was 18, with a big Rotterdam newspaper. And the editor of this newspaper, he actually lived in The Hague, where the Dutch, which is the seat of the Dutch parliament, and, you know, that's where all the political life takes place. And I think there was an American, what we'd call a parliamentary inquiry. They call it a grand jury or something hearing. It was called the Church Committee, and they were looking into practices of bribery by Lockheed and other defense contractors. And it was rumored in The Hague, it was rumored that a highly placed Dutch person had been mentioned in these secret hearings in America. So my boss, the editor, his name was Jan Prince. His surname was Prince. And he thinks, I want to get to the bottom of this. I want to hear what Lockheed's got to say about this. So he picked up the phone, phoned Lockheed, got to speak to a secretary of the a general manager.
There we go. This is a military aircraft manufacturing company, as well as they were making airliners and things like that too, weren't they, in the United States?
Exactly. And obviously, Europe had been in tatters after the Second World War, so all the European countries had become big clients of, you know, and it was the beginnings of NATO, and so everybody was buying ordnance and, you know, defense material. So business was booming, and my boss, Jan Prince, he phoned the United States, he phoned Lockheed, and got to speak to the secretary, who said, oh, very sorry, the boss is out to lunch. I'll gladly take your number and I'll get him to call you back. So my boss says, sure, this is my number. Please tell your boss Prince called. And about 20 minutes later, the phone rings and there's the general manager or whatever he was, the CEO of Lockheed, absolutely furious on the telephone going, I told you never to use the public phones. I told you not to talk to people, blah, blah, blah. How could you not discuss? And he just spilled all the beans about the bribing of Bernhard, the prince, not Jan Prince, the editor. And, this is how the story blew. And there was subsequently, obviously, in the Dutch parliament, there was this investigation and he just got rapped on the knuckles, really. You know, if you or I were to do something like that, take $1.1 million in bribes to use your influence to get purchasing contracts for the Dutch army, we'd be in prison. But this guy just got Oh, well, he was a bit careless with his contacts. He was overly trusting of the people that he knew. That was kind of the conclusion of the report. It's all whitewashing.
Yeah, it's interesting in a way. This is 1975 this took place. And the irony is that it was to do with a deal to purchase these Lockheed Starfighter jets, which yeah. weren't actually very good. In fact, the US Air Force bought a few of them, started using them. This is the Vietnam era, and realized that they had this tendency to fall out of the sky because the wings were too small. Basically badly designed. And so I imagine, in a way, Millie, it might have been that they'd manufactured these jets and the US Air Force was starting to turn their nose up at them, and they were looking to foist them off onto some, European power, maybe.
European power, yeah. After Bernard died, it also came to light that he also took bribes from Northrop, which was another aeroplane manufacturer. And the corruption actually goes further, because first of all, he denied absolutely everything, although there was plenty of evidence. There were letters between him and Lockheed. There were bank accounts that belonged to his stepfather that the money had been paid into, etc. But it was claimed, he claimed that any money that he'd received from any corporation was going to the World Wildlife Fund, which he was also, which he also set up. And,
Along with the Duke of Edinburgh. Yeah.
Exactly. And, there's a whole story of, him selling two works of art, at Sotheby's, I believe, or Christie's, by the by. For the sum of 2 million, is it Dutch guilders or was it pounds? I don't know. But basically, these paintings weren't worth very much at all. This money is supposed to have gone to the World Wildlife Fund. But really, it was a huge tax deal for Bernard and Juliana. There was like it was a tax scam, basically. The World Wildlife Fund he used to set up these reserves in Africa, particularly in Tanzania, supposedly himself and other rich people could freely enter there and go trophy hunting. And also he hired a private army. That's it. With the sale, with the sums raised by the auction of these paintings, he actually paid a private army of mostly British mercenaries in Tanzania who became heavily involved in the ivory trade themselves, not only in the illegal ivory trade of rhinoceros and elephant, but also they became involved in massacring black communities in then apartheid South Africa. So the whole thing, you know, it just reeks of to put it bluntly.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it was a book called The White Man's Game, which this is a few years ago now, maybe in the 1990s, that came out, which was looking at the World Wildlife Fund really as an intelligence asset. The idea being that people would never suspect that, as you were saying, you know, money donated to them was used for the ivory trade, to actually foster the ivory trade, to use private armies in Africa to harass regimes that weren't friendly to the European powers. I mean, we even saw in the 1960s, didn't we, the assassination of the UN Secretary General by European interests, who was down there trying to sort out some sort of private army that had probably been financed by Bernhard or somebody else similar. The World Wildlife Fund with the panda logo, I think people need to understand this is was a Western tool to just carry on colonialism, and in fact in a rather more sneaky and wicked fashion. But the other side of Bernhard's embarrassment in 1975, taking this $1 million bribe from Lockheed, was that he was then no longer able to chair the Bilderberg conferences, which had been going on by them for 20 years. And I mean, the Bilderbergers, I would characterize them as a kind of political lobby for NATO. So in other words, you know, the NATO interests, the military interests, want to make sure that they're going to get politicians in the European countries and in the States and Canada that
foster their interests rather than, you know, maybe somebody like Jeremy Corbyn doesn't really fit the bill. So what do you make of the Bilderbergers? Because their origin is in the Bilderberg Hotel just near Arnhem. What do you make of this phenomenon? Because it's essentially a Dutch thing, isn't it? And it certainly started in Holland.
Yeah. So let me just add that. So my former boss, Jan Prince, I actually stayed friends with him until his death. He always reckoned that the 1.1 million bribe had in reality been CIA money that should be used to counter the Cold War. So as you mentioned, Germany was kind of in between Russia and Europe. I don't know that I necessarily believe that, but so Bilderberg, I wouldn't have connected Bilderberg to NATO personally. I imagine Bilderberg to be a little club of megalomaniacs who want the world for themselves, you know, like the ultimate evil, like what's his name in the Pink Panther films, Dreyfus, Inspector Dreyfus, who wants to rule the world. And I think there is in my book, it was always just a club of the 200 richest people in the world who came together to discuss what they wanted. And I think NATO is their tool, not the other way around.
Well, maybe. I mean, it certainly is from the NATO countries that they were picked right from the start. They're not allowing anybody in really who isn't already part of that club. And also, you know, there are some people that go along to these Bilderberg conferences. They seem to be trying to schmooze them, like Will Hutton, who was the editor of The Observer back in the 1990s, wrote a piece in the paper which has now been forgotten and probably erased from most of the newspaper cutting libraries, which was very critical, calling them the high priests of globalization. So I think they're more trying to schmooze and almost like assess people to see whether they're. But I mean, you know, I think your expertise a lot, I think, is on the side of just sort of Dutch culture and Dutch politics. How powerful do you think the Dutch are still? Because the Dutch have for many years kind of rivaled the Brits in Europe as a powerful maritime power, and particularly to do with the field of trade. So, you know, what do you think is Holland's role these days?
I think, first of all, Tony, I think I saw a guest list of NATO maybe 10 years ago, and there was definitely presidents of Chinese banks on there, and surely China is not in NATO. So,
they do have, occasionally, they'll have Chinese people who are really, they're not from the Chinese government. That what they are is the NATO and the Western European, I mean, often they have, for example, Carnegie Foundation representatives in China. They may have a Carnegie Foundation person from Russia, for example, but they're not really representing those countries at all. They're representing the Western interests in those countries. Yeah. And that's only occasional. It's mostly just NATO interests that are there.
There was a member of parliament, a Dutch member of parliament, who asked a question in the lower house about the Dutch prime minister of the time, Balkenende. He was called Jan Peter Balkenende. He had attended, the prime minister had attended the Bilderberg conference that year. And his member of parliament said, had the prime minister attended in a private capacity or in an official capacity, and if it was the latter, would you please report back to the lower house exactly what takes place there? Well, he lasted another week, this member of parliament, and then he was stripped of his constituency and his, his role in the lower house. Like, you do not talk about Bilderberg in Holland. It's a hugely secretive society still. There are very specific channels that you have to go through, even as a student, even when you're 18 years old, you have to start trying to enter onto these paths to become a politician, to become a member of, you know, a future government, etc. And it's very much a cliquey society.
Well, I mean, it does seem very control freaky in Europe, particularly in the EU these days. What do you make of the European Union and the Dutch? Because when I was over there doing my talk, I think it was 2018, there's definitely, I mean, maybe it's just because of the subject matter that I was doing, which is the origins of the Bilderbergers and Hitler's private secretary Martin Bormann's involvement in the Second World War battle in Arnhem, and because I think that's why the meeting started in Oosterbeek just outside Arnhem, is because of a sort of in joke really
the spy who leaked Operation Market Garden, I forget his name, he was actually close friends with Bernard. And Bernard's own role, or rather the role of the Dutch monarchy in the Second World War, is just deplorable. First of all, they scarpered, you know, leaving the Dutch people. And they say it all came as a total surprise that the Netherlands got invaded, because in the First World War, it stayed neutral. And in fact, in the run-up to the Second World War, the Dutch were talking about, no, the Germans are our brothers, you know, we're all Germanic people, we're all one people, they won't invade us. Well, somehow or other, miraculously, the Queen and 40 million guilders of her assets, I mean, that's a vast fortune, can you imagine? 40 million in 1940, somehow they were ready to escape on the 10th of May when the Germans bombed Rotterdam. That is just amazing, isn't it, how they had that foresight to be ready.
Well, the guy anyway, Bernard, talking about, just to remind you, is Christian Lindemans, or King Kong. He was the spy, and I didn't realise exactly that he was quite so close to Bernhard.
Yeah. And Bernard supposedly engaged in diplomacy. He did all kinds of things during the Second World War, but basically, in a nutshell, the Dutch royal, so Queen Wilhelmina was in London, while Crown Princess Juliana, who's the wife, the future, the Crown Princess and the wife of Bernard, she and her children had gone to Canada to be well out of harm's way. But Bernard was all over the place. He was flying between Washington and Germany, between, Paris and London. So his role is really obscure, but I don't actually have any proof for this, I should say, but I hazard a guess that because what the Dutch did, the Dutch queen in London, Wilhelmina, she basically sat on the fence till 1943, telling the Dutch people to collaborate with the Germans, lest the infrastructure be damaged, or, you know, just collaborate, just do as they ask. The Dutch railways actually got paid a guilder of 50, which again was a vast fortune in 1940, for the transport of every Jew, one guilder of 50 for every Jew that got transported. Vast fortunes were made in the Netherlands. Schiphol Airport was built with Nazi money. Anyway, that's all by the by. But the Dutch monarch said collaborate until 1943. That's when Italy was invaded and the pincer movement, you know, was beginning to take place. So they were coming up through Italy, and then later the D-Day landings. And it was only at that point that the Dutch queen started to say, now start resisting, and told the Dutch railways to go on strike. And the Germans retaliated viciously, like literally starved the Dutch. As you know, in 1944, all the food was just removed from Holland for the German army, and the Dutch people starved.
Yeah, this is what they called the hunger winter. Must have been absolutely horrific. And the people who were throwing flowers over the Nazi convoys when they entered a few years before must have been really rather regretting that.
Yeah, people were literally, well, the stories are that people walked like 200 kilometers for a pram full of potatoes. You know, they would surrender their Rembrandt paintings for a loaf of bread. It was those are the kinds of stories. Anyway, I hazard a guess that the role of Bernard was to already put into place the future EU. So this is where I go towards your previous question. What's my feeling about the EU? I think that the Nazis were actually convinced to put down their weapons because their manifesto would be enacted anyway, because it was in everybody's interest to have a single European patent office, to have a single European currency, a single European language. That was in very much in the interest of IG Farben, which was the conglomerate of petrochemical and pharmaceutical companies that more or less bankrolled and prompted the Second World War. You know, so Bernard, I think, brokered that deal, said to the Germans, just, you know, put down your weapons, lose the war, and what you want will happen anyway, because everybody wants this. That's what I think.
Yeah, maybe right. I mean, I spoke to some people when I was in Holland who were saying, well, this is older people saying, well, at the end of the Second World War, the wrong people took over, saying that many of the people that were running Holland after the war, immediately after the war, had been the Nazi collaborators.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I think I mentioned to you a talk by Matthias Rath, who's a fierce critic of, well, both his own country, Germany, and the EU. And he has done an extensive amount of research into the origins of the EU. So the Netherlands became part of the Benelux, which is Belgium, Netherlands, and Luxembourg. So that was the very seedling of the European Union was Benelux. And then Benelux became European Economic Community. So France and Italy and Germany joined, if I'm not mistaken. So now it's six countries. And that then grew into what we now know as the European Union. But actually, you know, Nazi war criminals were fetched out of jail to become, you know, the presidents and what have you of this European economic community. It's bizarre.
Well, also integrated into NATO. I think the Soviet Union, Moscow must have been looking over saying, well, hang on a minute, what's the difference between this and what we were fighting a few years ago?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I feel much the same. I feel there are so many lobby groups in the European Union. Undoubtedly, there are politicians in there who mean well and who truly believe their remit. But if you look at a lobby group like Codex Alimentarius, for example, which is the lobby of the food and health industry together, I believe, they lobby in the guise of food safety standards and, you know, medicine safety standards, this sort of thing. But really, they are there to drive organic food off the shelves, to drive alternative practitioners out of business. I mean, they are clearly, you know, there to promote genetically modified organisms, the bee killing pesticides of Bayer, you know, land grab, all this kind of thing. And not at all what they purport to be. So this is where my hate of hypocrisy comes in. Like, I see these people for what they are, and I don't want to live with it. So in the Netherlands, for example, foraging was made illegal in 2014. You get fined if you get caught picking blackberries, because it's unsafe to pick wild food. You have to buy it in the supermarket. You know, if you grow tomatoes in your backyard, you have to pay tax on them because you deprive the state of VAT on shop-bought tomatoes.
So that's the lovely Jungle Bus Millie, who gives, I think, a fascinating insight into a Dutch perspective on the UK, and particularly nasty what she finishes up there with. I'll put the full version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Of course, it's about two or three times longer than that, but that was about 20 minutes. So really good chat with her. Someone who was on the inside in Dutch journalism back in the 1970s, and gave us, I think, some fascinating insights into the apparent collaboration between the, and also her, what about her take, Martin, on this whole idea that, well, actually the European Union is something that sprang out of the Nazis' plans for occupied Europe?
Well, we've had this debate many of the time, as you know. The European Union is a creature of NATO. That's the whole point. The whole point of creating the European Economic Community using martial aid from the United States was to prevent the communists from coming to power in places like France and Italy, and also and using Gladio methods and so forth. And the European Union has never been independent of NATO. And in fact, the European Union has slavishly followed the NATO line on everything that's been happening in the Ukraine. But then so have the British, even though they're not part of the European Union. They've been the most belligerent of all. There would have to be some kind of economic integration in Europe of some sort. The question is what sort?
Mm. Well, I don't think we've really left the EU at all, Martin. I mean, that's what the spin is. I mean, you know, what we're going to end up as is we're going to end up like Switzerland or Norway, one of these countries that's just got to do what we're told by Brussels, but we've got no say. And anyway, actually, to a certain extent, you know, what they've all that's really happened with the referendum to leave is that we're no longer treated to the radical MEPs being able to speak out. Not that they had any power, but at least that we could watch them speaking out in the European Parliament, even if they were powerless. Anyway, look, I want to get on to Dave Barnby. Well, we've got a lot to crack in. Make it quick.
Can I just make it? I'll be very brief. Britain has decided that we are not going to have our own standards in industries outside the EU. We are going to adopt lock, stock and barrel, the existing system of European standards.
Well, that's not Britain deciding that.
Inside the single market.
Conservative and Goldman Sachs has decided that. Anyway, we're going to hear now from Dave Barnby, who died earlier this year. He died about 3-4 months ago. And Dave was one of the people who helped me in my quest to get to the bottom of the Bilderbergers. Did a fantastic job in helping me out, really, looking at the links between particularly the NATO Secretaries General and this battle in the Second World War, the Battle of Arnhem, which my book, The Traitors of Arnhem, is about. But anyway, here's Dave Barnby speaking on a dialect show a long time ago. Gosh, must be probably a decade at least, maybe 2 decades ago, about this thing called the European Movement, which was this kind of political lobbying for a United States of Europe after World War II, rather like Millie was just indicating there.
Tell me a little bit about the European Movement specifically, not the European Union, but the European Movement.
Well, a movement generally to me implies a spontaneous desire of people to achieve a goal.
Okay.
In other words, a grassroots pressure group. Mm-hmm. But nothing could be more further from the truth about the European movement. It's an organised front for big business, or has been in the past and tends to be today.
Okay.
The EM, or the European movement, in fact, often acts more like a quango, and at the time it had his successful campaign to get us into the European Union. It was financed by the government, worked with the government as a department of the Foreign Office.
Okay, so it's an official organisation as such.
No, it pretended to be a grassroots organisation.
But, oh, I see.
But I've done the research, gone to the Public Record Office, and found out something somewhat different.
Okay.
And it came under the Information Research Department, which is a secret department of the Foreign Office, and they did such things as preparing material for the European movement. Their civil servants would prepare letters for the press, and ordinary members of the public ordinary members of the European movement who were somewhat duped into what they were doing, mm-hmm. would put these letters into the press. Okay. So you see a letter from Mr. Smith raving on about the benefits of joining the European movement,
okay.
or joining the European Union, when this letter was in fact written by a civil servant okay. behind the scenes.
So that's Dave Barnby there. Who helped me, he's credited as well in my book, The Traitors of Arnhem, to make the links between people like Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was a Dutch liaison officer with the British Army in September 1944, as well as particularly Lord Peter Carrington, who was sitting in his tank in the Grenadier Guards on the south side of Nijmegen Bridge, trundled across and then stopped. And they wouldn't go any further, even though they could have relieved with the American paratroopers in the 82nd Order, they could have relieved the British at the Arnhem Bridge. And even Sergeant Robinson went charging down the road and got rid of the last anti-tank guns that the Germans had there. I think it was a self-propelled gun. And so that whole episode is really recorded in the Traitors of Arnhem, my book, which is linking this horrific failure of the British to win that battle, a deliberate throwing of the battle in order to give the Nazis a few more months to finish squirreling away their wealth and arranging their affairs for the Fourth Reich that we're now dealing with at the end of the Second World War. So thanks to Dave for that. And Martin, you want any comments on the European movement? Because there was a lot of these CIA-funded and similar types of funded organisations that were pushing ever since the end of the Second World War. In fact, they started during World War II with the War and Peace Studies Group at the Council on Foreign Relations, preparing for the Bilderbergers and preparing for a US of Europe to make sure the whole of the continent behaved itself when it came to the United States and kept up barriers to the Soviet Union.
Well, the history of the European Union, or the European Economic Community, the common market, is bound up with the Marshall Plan and with the creation of NATO. They call it, you know, in the literature, they call it Euro-Atlantic integration. And, of course, Georgia, right out there in the Caucasus, is going to be part of the European Union and part of NATO. Israel isn't part of the European Union, but it is effectively part of NATO. This is all manipulation. There was going to be some kind of integration of the European economies. The question is, who's going to run it? Is it going to be run in the interests of the workers, or is it going to be run in the interests of the Americans and the bosses? We know what the answer to that question is. We would have had to have something like the European Union, even if it had been conceived in a genuine way as a genuine attempt to integrate the European economy rather than just as a front for the US. Look what's happened now. The whole of the European economy is going to be pushed into a devastating depression in order to salvage the US position.
Well, that's right. I mean, that certainly seems that Kissinger's dream of being able to make one.
The Americans blew up the German Russian.
Kissinger's dream, Martin.
Why have you got a cost of living crisis?
The Kissinger's dream of just being able to phone up one person to get. For the Americans to just phone up one person, that is Ursula von der Leyen, to get their way in Europe, has now come to fruition rather than these 20 different presidents, prime ministers, etc. That's all.
What they were really worried about, Tony, is a democratically elected communist government in Italy, which could have been quite a competent government and made everybody think, hey,
certainly if the EU is running the show, there's no chance of that, and particularly with the security apparatus. Look, we're going to talk nuclear bombs now.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
Well, it's coming on for, 70 years now since that. But also interesting, isn't it, that Harry Truman, I mean, well, maybe you know something about this. I've always thought maybe that Roosevelt was bumped off because he was against the use of the atomic bomb on a city, and Roosevelt said it should be used in the countryside somewhere as a way of warning the Japanese that what it was capable of. But he died, and Vice President Truman took over and got his way.
Well, that's true. That's what happened. And there's quite a lot of stuff because of the anniversary in the Oppenheimer film. Good stuff on Consortium News I was reading today. Lots of the top brass, military top brass in the US said there's no military justification for this. The Japanese had already agreed to surrender. And they say, why won't you accept our surrender? You can surrender, but not yet, because we want to show the Soviets what we got.
It was a political decision.
Why don't we nuke the Soviet Union now,
I mean, Winston Churchill was, they had to keep him off the BBC because he was talking about that. But I mean, the point here surely is it sends a very clear message to the post-war world. America has got the nuclear bomb. Do as you're told by America. And if you don't, you may get a nuclear bomb. But secondly is in a more sinister way, rather like the current war in Ukraine. What you've got is it's a live test. What you can do is you're trying this stuff out on live human beings, dying human beings, and you can see over the next few decades how long it takes them to die, and you can stick them under the microscope and have a look, which you couldn't have done if Roosevelt had got his way.
Well, it would be nice to think that Roosevelt would have been more humane. It's possible that he wouldn't have had the power to stop this from happening anyway, because once they got it, they were determined to use it. I mean, MacArthur wanted to use it on China in the Korean War, and Truman had to sack him. He said, no, we're not doing that. Because by that stage, of course, the Soviets had got the bomb. And there's a possibility that they would have used it on the Americans. So there was a bit of a deterrence there. But, you know, it was quite clear that the Western leadership were definitely discussing, why don't we use this on the Soviets?
Yep, so this Oppenheimer film makes it all worth watching. But, of course, there'll be quite a lot that's not in there, including the things we've discussed just there about whether there was any need to use the bomb in the first place and what was the actual purpose of it. But I think, for me, one of the far more interesting things is Frisch and Piles in Nuffield University in Birmingham in 1940 came up with the memo, which was the first apparent design for a nuclear weapon. And they were saying, well, hang on, guys, because most of the experts in all this are Germans and Eastern Europeans in nuclear physics. They'd split the atom for the first time in 1938 in Berlin. And their message to the British war machine, to Churchill and the rest of them, was, look, guys, you've really got to develop this because the Germans may be ahead of us. And if they are, this is the most horrific weapon the world has ever seen. And we don't want the Nazis to get there first. Obviously, there was a very, very developed Nazi weapons program, but it's possible that some of the Nazi experts were secretly were trying not to develop a bomb because they weren't all that happy with it. Because quite a lot of Eastern European physicists came over, didn't they, to the British and the Americans. The other thing is the Quebec Agreement, which is where the British had designed this thing and were working with these physicists. Churchill and Roosevelt decided we're going to go and develop this thing over in the United States because at least we know then the Nazis won't be able to bomb our laboratories, which are trying to develop it. Anyway, let's have a listen now to rest in peace, old Manfred Petritsch, whose father was a Nazi scientist, although he was working anyway for the Nazi war machine, developing the jet engine. And with this Oppenheimer film, I think it makes it even more interesting to listen back to his take from the Nazi community after the war as to how much technology from the Nazis went into that US bomb, those first two, and particularly the second of the two bombs. Just to make it clear, the first of the two bombs on Hiroshima was a uranium gun bomb, which is where two bits of uranium get fired into each other and go critical and explode very quickly together. That's enriched uranium, that's U-235, by the way. And the second bomb, Fat Man, was a plutonium bomb, and the plutonium is taken out as the nuclear pile burns away and gets hot, so plutonium is formed in there. It's not a naturally occurring substance, and that plutonium was used to make the second bomb. But as Manfred explains here, he believes that the Nazi technologists and scientists have worked out a way, which was used by the Americans, of actually exploding the plutonium bomb, which was much more difficult as it was it needed to have explosives wrapped all around it that exploded all at exactly the same time in order to make the thing go bang.
We all know, who have studied history about the Second World War, that it was the Soviet Union who defeated Hitler and the Third Reich, and not the West. You can see it just alone by the number of divisions that Germany used. They used 250 divisions against the Soviets and only 25 divisions against the West. So it's a 10-to-1 deployment of military forces between East and West. And still, the Soviets managed to absolutely destroy the German Wehrmacht. So what the West was up against was just a tiny fraction of the German forces. And the same applies, by the way, to Japan. It was the Soviets who actually defeated Japan by defeating an army of 1.2 million Japanese soldiers in Manchuria at the end of the war. And the Japanese actually capitulated because they were afraid that the Soviets were about to invade Japan. I mean, they were ready to invade Japan, and that's why they capitulated.
What about the German ability to build an atomic bomb? A lot of people have been saying that actually that was quite advanced during World War II.
I can tell you that I've spoken a long time ago with one of the scientists who was involved in this project, and they actually tested, they actually did two explosions, two atomic explosions during the war. One was done in the Lüneburger Heide, and one was done on one of the North Sea islands. They were comparatively tiny explosions. They were very far advanced. And the reason why the Americans with the Manhattan Project had a big problem, they didn't know how to ignite the atomic bomb. They didn't know how to ignite it. And that's why they had to wait until Germany was occupied and get the technology. That's why they were able to do the first explosion in July of 45. They had to wait until they got the technology from the Germans.
So was Churchill right to be worried about an atomic bomb being on the end of a V2 heading for London?
Absolutely, sure. But not only a V2. The Germans had the four-engine bombers who were able to hit New York. They would have been able to also hit the east coast of the United States.
So why didn't the Nazis use the atomic bomb if they had it then?
Because Hitler did not put much priority on that for some strange reason. He didn't prioritize the atomic weapon. Maybe he didn't understand it or something. He also didn't give much resources to this development.
So I guess the people of London in the 1940s and New York should be very glad that they didn't get nuked.
In a way, yes. Well, then the Japanese got it. The bombs were dropped on Japan.
Do you think there's any likelihood of a nuclear war with the North Koreans? Is that real or is it just rhetoric?
No, it's not real. Because if America does anything, then South Korea and also Japan is gone. There are 35,000 American soldiers in South Korea. They will be all dead.
Is there anything positive you see in around the world for the next year, 2018?
Well, I see a positive. I see that China and Russia are working together, together with Iran, and also India is coming into play. They have definitely going away from the dollar as a dominant currency. What definitely is happening is that America is a declining imperium. You know, it's a declining power.
Aren't declining powers dangerous?
Sure, they are. They can think that maybe as a last resort, let's throw some bombs around the place. You see, the problem is that a lot of people are not taking America serious anymore. I mean, you saw it when Obama visited China. The Chinese didn't even roll out a set of stairs to his Air Force One plane. They didn't give him stairs so that he could step out of his plane. That means there is no more respect for America. It's lost a lot of its credibility, and especially now in regarding Syria. I mean, the winner is definitely Russia, and everybody knows what they can do now, right? I mean, what we have seen is that Russia used Syria to test its weapons, to improve the whole military. It was a testing ground, because there's always a difference between theory and practice. And they have used this war to show the world also what they're capable of. And their electronic capabilities are far beyond what the West can do. Electronic warfare, they're really number one in that area.
So that's Manfred Petrich, no longer with us, passed away now, but some fascinating insights there from 2017. Gosh, long time ago, 6 years ago. And Martin, his take is on the Russian involvement in Syria there, but you could apply this, I suppose, to Ukraine too. Now is a much more involvement with directly between the Anglo-Zionist Empire and Moscow there. There is this ridiculous dilemma, isn't there, in Ukraine? where you've got the Russians thinking, well, if the war stops, then Ukraine, under a peace agreement and with agreed borders, may just go click and join NATO, and they don't want that.
Well, I think the problem is that there are sort of dissident voices in the establishment in the West talking about, well, we'll have to sort of do a deal. And of course, the Saudis, you know, to keep the Americans happy, just had this peace meeting about Ukraine where the Russians weren't invited, but the Chinese turned up because they're trying to cultivate the Saudis. So they were humouring them, basically. But there was nothing came out of that meeting because the Russians aren't interested in talking to people who don't stick to their existing agreements. Hollande and Merkel openly said that we double-crossed Putin at Minsk. We didn't have any intention of making peace with the Russians. We did a good job because we fooled Putin. And then, of course, the Ukrainians were able to build up their forces so that they could retake the Donbass republics. Now, the whole basis of Minsk was a ceasefire and a discussion about how things could be settled without violence. But, of course, the West was never interested in settling this without violence. No. And, of course, the Russians are now not interested in talking to the West.
Yeah, so in a way, it makes it one of the most dangerous Hiroshima and Nagasaki days. And there have been this week in Castle Park here in Bristol a whole sort of a CND peace thing and Extinction Rebellion involved as well, I think, to commemorate all that, which is nice to see. Just a little bit of bookkeeping: the Nazi roots of the Brussels EU. That's Matthias Ruth, Paul Anthony Taylor, Alexandra Nedzivecki. So that I'll put a link up to that on our show page. That's the book that Jungle Bus Millie mentioned earlier on. Plus also the Workers' Party GB. That is a campaigning party set up by, I do believe this is the correct one. Gosh, I'm sure it is. Yes, here we go. George Galloway and Chris Williamson. WorkersPartyBritain.org. Is that one. And we'll finish with a couple of clips from a documentary. This is, of course, how history repeats itself with these kind of nuclear spies. And this is, I think, fascinating new documentary by Ryan Dawson called How Israel Stole the Atomic Bomb and Killed JFK. Let's have a listen to the first clip now.
Never had a weapon annihilated a city and its people in seconds. The whole world saw the demonstration. The European powers recognized the Americans had then declared themselves the new superpower. It was a new world order.
An iron curtain has descended across the continent. Ladies and gentlemen, the United States stands at this time at the pinnacle of world power. An awe-inspiring accountability to the future.
A new problem emerged in peacetime. The weapons surplus across continents was no longer necessary. Some weapons used in the beginning of the war had been made obsolete and were replaced with more advanced models by the end of the war. Black markets for illegal as well as legal arms trades thrived. The OSS had morphed into the CIA. Other states had created likewise counterparts. The age of intelligence agencies and covert war had come.
A clip from Ryan Dawson's film. Interesting to hear Churchill there. It's almost as if the real problem is the Soviet Union. Actually, the real problem, right from word go, was it seemed to be actually the former Nazis in NATO, Martin, from 1949 onwards. And particularly the Americans were really being bully boys around the world, weren't they, right from the end of World War II?
Well, that's right. They basically didn't support the British and the French over Suez. That was the end of the British and the French empires, and the Americans basically took them over as going concerns. The Nazis were indeed integrated into the Western intelligence structure. Reinhard Gehlen, who came to be head of the BND, the West German Intelligence Services, used to be the head of the Gestapo. The Russians, that's pretty obvious to the Russians what's going on there. Now, that doesn't mean that the Russians necessarily were entirely, you know, blameless in world affairs. But on the other hand, we got to be clear about who the real bullies are. And of course, in actual fact, as we can now see with the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, Bormann will be turning in his grave because the Americans have double crossed the Germans here. a British.
Look, I mean, Bormann didn't really care to be a German. He just wanted to go. He wanted to be with whoever was the most powerful gang at the time.
That's right. And you can see it's quite clear who wears the trousers in the relationship between Germany and the United States. And that, of course, allows Britain to feel that it's superior because we are America's best friend. And, the Germans are now, they're definitely out. But there's the consequences of all of this are still to play out because there's going to be a depression now in Europe for a generation, probably. The Russian economy won't collapse. The Chinese economy probably won't collapse. The US economy won't collapse in the short run, but in the long run, a collapse in Europe is fatal to the Europe.
Well, it certainly could be. By the way, I will leave up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Sorry, I haven't quite managed to circulate last week's show. I've been so busy up in London and doing various other things this week. I'll circulate it this weekend. Is my brief history of NATO, that is to say, the talk, so you can look at me doing my little talk, 15 minutes opposite Downing Street, but more importantly in some ways, it's a sort of timeline, really, from 1948 in the State of Israel and 49 with the creation of NATO right the way through to today, where the United States Air Force is now negotiating to fly its deadly drones out of RAF Fairford here in Gloucestershire. So lots and lots in between, but a bit of an ignominious lot. But anyway, look, our final clip is also from this programme by documentary by Ryan Dawson about how Israel stole the atomic bomb and killed JFK.
After World War II and the Holocaust, the Jewish Agency / Haganah were a politically sensitive and difficult faction to prosecute. Also, because of Jewish identity politics, many American Jews in positions of influence were Israeli nationalists and looked the other way or even assisted in the smuggling post-World War II weapons surplus out of the United States to Israel. The Zionist plot to take Palestine predates World War II, so it cannot be said to be a reaction to the Holocaust. The confidence Zionists gained and the proven reliability of Sanem assets inside the U.S. during the decades preceding the creation of Israel propelled the first new government of Israel to continue smuggling operations out of the United States. The United States seemed unwilling to prosecute them, which in part emboldened the chutzpah to a level of nuclear theft. If the smuggling had been stopped at TNT, it never would have escalated to uranium. The operation had three types of players: smugglers, financiers, and the political cover-up. The Zionists honed in on the War Assets Administration, which is where the Americans would be decommissioning a vast array of weapons. The U.S. government made strict arms export controls, so illegal procurement and trafficking had to be created. To get the weapons from the WAA they desired, the terrorists would have to have organization, finance, a method of acquisition and transportation. The organization was the Sonneborn Group, a stateside nexus of Jewish supremacist millionaires who worked hand in glove with the Jewish Agency in Haganah. Finance came from wealthy partisans, false charities, and organized crime.
That's Ryan Dawson's new documentary, NUMEC, NUMEC, How Israel Stole the Atomic Bomb and Killed JFK. Martin, what do you make of this? I mean, it was quite amazing, wasn't it, the way the Israelis got the bomb, and they still don't admit to having it.
Well, if they did admit to having it, under the Logan Act, the US would have to put sanctions on them because it's on the statute book, which is why they don't do it. Well, I mean, you know, to people who listen to this show, this is not going to be great revelation, is it? I think it is important to point out that the Israeli lobby and the Zionist lobby were very active before Hitler came to power, before the Holocaust. And, of course, during the World War II, the Jabotinskyite right wing in Israel, they cooperated with the Nazis, and they carried on their armed campaign against the British Army, even while the British Army was fighting in the Western Desert against Erwin Rommel. The State of Israel is a terrorist state. I mentioned this book, State of Terror, which has come out relatively recently. Everything to do with it is terroristic. And of course, they accuse the Palestinians of doing exactly what they've done for years and years and years.
Yeah, and now we've got a dictatorship looming there with thousands, tens of thousands of Israelis coming out onto the streets and saying, no, this is not the country we're going to be part of. We're refusing to be part of it, which is fantastic to see. Even though they're not there to specifically stick up for the Palestinians, those people are there.
Are just disinterested in this. They can't see any positive in it for them.
Well, I can. I mean, even if they can't, the idea is that the Israelis actually do want a democracy, and of course it's been undermined like ours has, but the Israeli population are saying this is going too far. We're not going to accept a dictatorship, however much Netanyahu feels that he can't get away with his racist policies without becoming a dictator. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko, and a special thanks to Jungle Bus Millie this week. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe also to my weekly, almost weekly, a little bit slack this week, email list. And even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join Not the BCFM Politics Show on talkradio.org.uk live stream next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Cinnamon tree. The name of the rabbit is not reported.